Clyde Ball, but now it's time for Nick Abbott.
Thanks, Rachel. A packed programme tonight. We will hear the latest on the incredible jewellery heist at the Louvre in Paris, and we'll check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. Plus, a Reform MP apologises, sort of, after saying that seeing TV ads full of black people drives her mad. Supermarkets are saying that any attempt to tax them will hurt us. Those off sick with depression or anxiety will be told to get a job as a sort of therapy, and we'll hear how more appointments and procedures are to be contracted out to the private sector by the NHS. But first, the prisoner, accidentally and apparently reluctantly released early, has been re-apprehended. But is the really shocking thing about all this how ordinary an incident it is? That and more coming up with me after 10.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. The father of one of the victims of the sex offender and asylum seeker mistakenly released from prison on Friday has called the error unbelievably irresponsible. The Justice Secretary says Hadush Kabatu will be deported back to Ethiopia this week after being arrested in North London this morning. He was given a 12-month sentence for attacking a woman and a 14-year-old girl. The Epping Forest councillor, Shane Yerrill, has been reading out a statement from her father.
I had to find out from a reporter that my daughter's attacker was accidentally released in the day, then be sent images and videos of him walking around throughout the day before the police even alerted her mother. Then later that day, when I attended HMP Chelmsford to seek some answers, I was greeted with hostility and complete disregard for anything I said or asked.
Russia says it has successfully tested a nuclear-powered cruise missile, which it claims can pierce any defence shield. The announcements come from President Putin. The Kremlin's military says it travelled 8,700 miles during a flight lasting about 15 hours. Reports from Paris say two arrests have been made by police investigating last Sunday's robbery at the Louvre Museum. Prosecutors have refused to confirm numbers, but have said one man was detained while trying to leave France. The art detective Arthur Brand says professional criminals are now stealing different things.
In the past, they were targeting famous paintings, but nowadays they target precious metals, gold, silver, diamonds, because, you know, you can melt down gold, you can melt down silver, you can dismantle objects that contain diamonds.
The Prime Minister is expected to fly to Turkey tomorrow for talks about arms sales. He's due to discuss an order for Typhoon fighter jets after being invited there by President Erdogan. And a new survey is claiming the average person has seen no meaningful improvement in their life during Labour's first year in power. 7,000 people were interviewed by the Life in the UK study from the charity Carnegie UK. It says it found stagnating well-being and persistent economic hardship for millions of people since 2023. LBC weather, clear spells followed by scattered showers overnight, particularly for northern and western areas. Winds will strengthen as well, but especially along eastern and western coasts. We'll see a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. The man who was accidentally freed from prison has been re-arrested following a three-day hunt. Hadush Kabatu was detained by officers inside Finsbury Park in North London at about 8:30 this morning. The Ethiopian was set free from HMP Chelmsford in error on Friday, just 4 weeks after being sentenced for sexually assaulting a girl and a woman in Essex. Shabnam Chowdhury is a former detective superintendent in the Metropolitan Police and joins us on the line now to talk about this. Hello, Shabnam.
Good evening, Nick.
This is an odd one, isn't it? Because it wasn't a prison break and he didn't appear to want to leave because he hung outside the prison for an hour and a half before effectively being told to go away by prison officers. That's not usual behaviour for someone who's just been released from prison, is it? Do you think that warning bells should have been sounding at that point?
I think that it would have been helpful if they'd have actually tried to listen to what he was telling them at the time, which was, as I understand it, that he was expected to be deported. He then sought the help of one of the delivery drivers, and then was eventually directed towards Chelmsford train station to make his own way, allegedly, to the deportation location. So, yes, certainly not the actions of a man that was happy to either be released or to escape. Then, obviously, at some point, he must have known or believed that he should have been somewhere or handed himself in, and then it went on to travel halfway across London, really.
Yeah, and he didn't appear to be on the run either, because he didn't avoid public areas. He went shopping, he went to a library and a hotel, and apparently he wanted to be returned to Ethiopia, his home country. So he seems to have been released reluctantly.
Yeah, I think, bearing in mind he wanted to go back to his place of residence in Ethiopia, and then obviously you saw the footage in Chelmsford where he seemed quite relaxed, or certainly asking for directions, headed into a library. Maybe he's gone to the library just to seek some time to have some space to breathe, or, you know, somewhere to sit where it might have been a bit warmer for him. But, you know, it was from there on that he was literally there to seek his own devices as to what he was going to do and where he was planning to head. I think he must have known, or certainly realised, that his time with that short sort of period of freedom was not going to last very long. He did actually have a change of clothes at some point, which I think I'd mentioned in interviews yesterday, that I'd have expected him to change clothing very, very quickly if he was determined to stay on, not on the run, but certainly as a free man at that point. But that didn't appear to be the case either.
Yeah, so, I mean, presumably the clothes that he was released in weren't really suitable for the how cold it is outside now.
No, and to everybody else, just a grey tracksuit would seem quite normal, but this was prison-issue tracksuit. He then changed later on into a jacket and some trousers and wandered freely. I mean, look, London is a very big multicultural city, 6 million people, CCTV cameras absolutely everywhere. It was really only a matter of time.
Well, let's talk about how this must have happened. I mean, the prison service, in fact, every aspect of law and order was starved of funds under the Tories. The prison's dangerously overcrowded. Prison officers are leaving in huge numbers. They've got something like a 15% leaving rate, which is incredible. Morale is at rock bottom. All of that sounds like a recipe for mistakes to be made.
Yeah, and if you look at how he may well have come to be released, you know, one individual has been subjected to being suspended, but I don't think this is about the one individual that should be held to account. This is about the systems and the processes. Now, I'm no expert on prison services and how their systems operate, but I am aware that when somebody is, say, for example, charged, and then they're remanded in custody, and then they're convicted, that time comes off their sentence, and then as they serve their 10th sentence, they get a released with 40% served. And it's all the you know, the timings around this, and then the completion of all these forms, trying to get the maths right, which is where I think some of these issues occurred, because their systems and processes appear to be completely broken. So, you know, this isn't uncommon. It's quite common for many of these prisoners to be released on error. I think last year was more than 250. The year before that, a significant number that were released on error. So it's a problem that has been recurring. And exactly as you say, they're leaving in their droves. They don't want to come in and do the job. It's a challenging, stressful role. I'm not sure about the fight, you know, the pay, but they don't seem to have the right support and the right mechanisms in place for the prison services to be run smoothly.
The way you've just described it sounds extraordinary. That's how somebody gets released from prison, that an officer on their own does the maths and deducts 40% plus whatever time they were in police custody, and then determines for themselves when that person is released. Is that really how it's done?
I think what happens is that they'll get a significant number of papers, one that will say that he served this much time, another one that says that he's, you know, they've got, they served 40% and that can be released. And then there's a whole plethora of other you know, issues that come into mind as well. As I say, I'm not an expert on these, but from what I understand, it's very complex. It's not as simple as just filling out a form, checking to see that the timelines, the dates, and then somebody's added up the figures. I think that these are all put together and somehow they're worked out. And the person that does the administration just goes by what they've been given and says, okay, time to stamp you out, and off you go. And, you know, this individual was trying desperately to go back inside, or at the very least, to be given some form of direction, because he actually told them, as I heard, that he was due to be deported, but they didn't seem interested.
Yes, as the computer says otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Computer says no, and therefore off you go.
I think is it true to say that the prison service is suffering from the same consequences of austerity that the police service is suffering from, and that is a lot of experienced officers have left over the last 15 years or so, and in something of a panic, the Tory government tried to replace the police officers that they'd lost, with the result that they lost a lot of experienced officers and replaced them with a lot of green officers who had no experience at all, and because of the numbers involved, were perhaps unsuitable for the task. Is the same thing true for the prison officers?
I would suspect yes. I mean, the Tories cut policing by 20,000, which is a huge and significant number. As a result of that, a number of officers were leaving. At the moment, it's like a revolving door. So as one comes into policing, one will leave. The average service is between 2 and 5 years. And I suspect it's the same within the prison services, that you're getting people that are coming in young in service that don't necessarily have the skills before they've even come into that organisation, that don't have the, you know, the relevant training, are kind of thrown in at the deep end, and it's a question of sink or swim. Within policing, that has been a real challenge for policing within the last 10 years because of because of what had happened with the last Conservative government. And I think that even though people will say, you know, the government will say we've increased numbers by 10,000, we haven't increased numbers by 10,000 because you're just still making up the shortfall. And I think within the prison services, as I've said, it's pretty much the same. I think the, you know, the criminal justice, the prison services, the policing are all at breaking point. And when you've got three huge organisations that intertwine with each other, whether it's through arrest, you know, charging, conviction, to going through the court process, to then going through into the prison services, you know, they're bursting at the seam. They don't have the capacity to hold the prisoners. And so they try to get them out as quickly as possible. And as a result of trying to get them out as quickly as possible, these errors or these problems are not being fixed. Let's hope that the government now have actually woken up to this, because they would have been aware that people get released by error. But because they've not necessarily been high profile, it's just been... It's almost as if it's, oh, that's okay, it's part and parcel of the job. These things happen, but, you know, we'll just carry on as normal. And I think that the problem's got bigger and bigger, and it's now at the point where they seriously have to do something.
Yeah, it's a very particular job, isn't it, being a prison officer? Because, I mean, they're sort of lumped in with police officers in some people's minds, but police officers are chasing after criminals in the public domain, whereas prison officers are trapped inside with those prisoners. So it's, you would imagine that it's much more detrimental to morale.
Yeah, I mean, policing is a really challenging job. It's a stressful job. Every day you don't know what's going to happen. I've been spat at, kicked, punched, all sorts of things. But I still personally would never have done the job of a prison, within the prison, prisons, because you're in a confined space. You don't have the tools, for example. You don't have tasers. You don't have the kind of batons. You don't have pepper spray. If you're attacked in a small confined space, it must be really scary. But obviously, you know, you do the job to the best of your ability. But it's not what I would call an attractive option to go into. So there's got to be something within that a role that attracts people that are really, really genuinely want to make life better for prisoners so that they can rehabilitate them and then send them back in, out into the real world and, you know, and trying to be better people.
I mean, you mentioned that you weren't sure how much they're paid, and I'm not entirely sure myself, but I think that the latest figure I saw was about £30,000, which is, it's not enough to take on the kind of responsibilities and the dangers that you've just described. And so what we find now is that foreign applicants make up about 50% of job applicants to be prison officers and about 22% of staff hired, mostly, apparently, from Nigeria. Now, that would suggest that with the potential communication problems, it is a recipe for, as I said before, it's even more likely that mistakes are going to be made in that circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the language barriers are within those prisons, but that doesn't surprise me in terms of the fact that you might get people from, you know, that foreign that come in and apply for those jobs, because the same applies in, for example, the care system. You know, you'll have a significant number of people of colour that apply for visas to come to do those jobs here in the UK. I don't really understand why, you know, people across the UK don't necessarily apply for those jobs or want to do those jobs. They're not jobs that are, you know, they're not jobs that you go to every day and come home of an evening and think, yeah, I've had a really great day. You know, I remember coming home from policing on evenings when I'd been involved in, you know, a critical incident, a murder, and I'd be sat there at midnight, having got home at midnight, and then at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you're still, you know, you still haven't come down from what's happened throughout that day. And I would imagine the same applies within the prisons because of the nature of the people that they're dealing with. At least with me, I go home and the people that I deal with that I might have arrested or that might be really horrible people, done horrible things, not necessarily horrible people, just done really horrible things. Those prison officers have to go back day in, day out, and deal with some of those prisoners that are really difficult and really, really challenging. So when you add that to some of the errors that are being made within the prison services, you've got to look at, you know, are there welfare issues? Are there mental health issues within the prison services? Are they being given the right support? Is the paperwork so bureaucratic that they can't change those systems and processes to make them more streamlined so that we don't get the mistakes that are being made? Thank goodness this individual didn't go out to commit further offences. And also, look at the impact that it's had. I was listening to the father of the child who wasn't even made aware that he'd actually been released back into the public domain and how distraught he was and how much of an impact that must have had on the victim. Now, that is something that we know about because it's a high-profile case. There will be many, many cases like that that we won't know about because they're not publicised. So something has got to change within the prison authorities to streamline it better, to ensure that these individuals are not released by error and that they only released at the time that they should be released and then either monitored by probation or the right authorities if that is necessary in the case.
Very good to talk to you, Shabnam. Thanks so much for that. That's Shabnam Chowdhury, former detective superintendent in the Metropolitan Police. Also, what do you make of all this? I mean, it does sound like a recipe for disaster, doesn't it? Morale is low, staff numbers are low, the turnover is huge. I mean, it's not really the kind of job that you would look forward to, perhaps, going to every day. I would be absolutely terrified. Apart from replacing prison officers with infallible robots, what can be done to eliminate error that has not been tried before? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Fanning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling and the whole world smiles with you.
Fanning banningdental.co.uk.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yeah, we're talking about what's wrong with the prison service, and it seems like the answer to that is a lot. Apart from the desperately low morale of prison officers, and apart from the fact, like the police service, many, many experienced officers are leaving to be replaced by obvious extension, people who have no experience at all. And many of them are of questionable suitability, I would suggest. And the same is true of police and prison officers. And mistakes are made astonishingly frequently. The year 2022 to 23, 81 prisoners were released in error, and it's just got worse from there. The last year it was 115 prisoners released in error, and to this year, 262. 262 prisoners were released in error. And the increase has been linked to severe prison overcrowding, the introduction of the early release scheme aimed at easing the overcrowding crisis, which has probably just added to the confusion if it is the case that prison officers have to do the maths to see who should be released next. And, of course, the mismanagement of the prison system and the law and order system in general over the last 15 years. So what, if anything, can be done to eliminate error in such a vital industry? Reading. Hello, David.
Hi there. I am an ex-prison officer, and ultimately all I saw was just a system collapse going on. I don't think it's just one person to blame or even...
Can you describe what you mean by system collapse?
So, ultimately, we've got prisoners going inside for issues that, you know, they might just be a really decent human being that is a husband, maybe they've got kids, and just because they're caught up in a system where maybe they do a bit too many drugs, they get caught, they might go down for 10 years. And it's like, what is actually going on when, okay, you can say some of the Class A's, they really impact people's lives, people need to do time. But does that time have to be inside? If they're a decent human being, can they go to the communities? Can we get them cleaning the streets? The waterways are a problem. There's a whole bunch of other things that we can get people to do other than put them behind bars where they're not actually a danger. There's a whole bunch of people that are a danger that should definitely be inside, but we're overcrowding with all sorts of issues that don't need to be inside and behind bars.
When you were a prison officer, what made you leave?
So that's a really good question, Nick. There's a whole bunch of reasons. One of the things was a manager turning around to me and saying that he was running a business. Another thing was that I couldn't actually trust who I was working with. So many drugs coming in. Yes, we've got drones. Yes, we've got other people that aren't prison officers coming into the prisons. But also, they know, and there's facts to say the prison officers are bringing them in. So it's okay, but when that's a heightened part of the job and you're expected to report on every last detail, from one smell to just peculiar, like, people visiting each other, then it becomes just an over-paranoid system. And it's really, really dangerous. I believe that in Tony Blair's government, they halved the prison officers, something like 8 to a wing down to 4 to a wing, approximately. And it's become dangerous. Some of the wings that I was on, they were unlocked, not necessarily everybody, but with maybe only two officers on the wing. That might be 50 unlocked to two. It's really dangerous. You know, and some of the people.
As far as releasing people, what is the procedure for determining who gets released?
I think it's changed. And it was a few years ago since I was working. I think there's been these new release situations. I think that maybe there's a lot of tired and overworked people, and also obviously it's just a huge ridiculous error. So I think that this is also a media issue where we're now using a global majority person to just continue this ridiculous reform far right stuff going on. So I just think that this one particular issue has been highlighted for an agenda, and I don't understand why. It's part of this process.
Well, I think the reason, if it's been hijacked for an agenda, I think that's pretty obvious why. All right, good to talk to you, David. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. It does seem odd, though. I haven't done the job. I can't imagine you actually have to go through on a daily basis. But if you release a prisoner and they seem confused, that would ring alarm bells in my mind. And if an hour and a half later they still hadn't left the exit door at the prison and you had to actually shoo them away, well, that can't be a part of your normal experience as a prison officer, surely. You would think that people would be running out of the place. But that is apparently what happened. He didn't quite understand what was happening, because he apparently wanted to be returned to Ethiopia, which was part of the plan. And he hung outside the prison for an hour and a half, unsure about what was actually happening to him, before prison officers told him to effectively get lost. I mean, alarm bells would have been ringing in my mind. I think I would have double-checked the paperwork. But, you know, maybe that's just me. 0345 6060 973 South Kensington. Hello, Leonard.
Oh, I'm not in South Kensington, Mick. I'm on the Algarve, my friend.
Oh, very nice.
I think a lot of this is just the lower, you know, the usual lack of standard in the training. And obviously, I think the type of people that go in for that job to begin with, I think that probably explains quite a bit, as your previous caller demonstrated. And what was the right-wing stuff about, I'd like to know. I mean, those people that are in prison are not the least bit interested in politics, because it's politics that let them down to begin with.
Well, I think the point that he was making is certain politicians are making hay with this, despite the fact, certainly if they're Tory politicians who are complaining, as they naturally are, under their rule, in July 2017, an inmate who was released from prison just months into a 9-year sentence due to a clerical error was arrested after weeks on the run. That happened under the Conservative government of Theresa May. In December 2019... the Prisons and Probation Service apologised after serial rapist Joseph McCann was freed to commit a series of sex attacks on women and children, which happened under the Conservative government of Boris Johnson. 115 prisoners were released in error in the 12 months to March 2024 under the Conservative government of Rishi Sunak. So take the Tories' ire with a pinch of salt in this, because they're just as guilty, if that's the right word, as the current administration.
I think they just highlight the exceptional cases, don't they? I mean, it's not happening every day, every week, and every month, and every year.
Kind of is. 262 were released in error in the year 24 to this year. So, you know, that's not far off one a day.
Well, I suppose, since when, though? Since when?
Well, in the year to 20 to I don't know what month to 2025, but anyway, in the last year, 262, in the year before, 115, and in the year before that, 81 prisoners were released in error. It actually does happen all the time.
Well, the Tories were obviously to some degree responsible for that then, because they were in power. But then, you know, I'm of the opinion that a great many of them should try out a little bit of prison time and see how it feels, you know?
Well, yes, that sounds like a great idea, Leonard. Let's keep that in mind. Yes. All right. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850, email nick@lbc.co.uk, and if you're on WhatsApp, then it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts on this and how something like this could have happened. I'd be interested to talk to you if you are within the prison system. If you're a prison officer, then it'd be interesting to know what the procedure is for the release of a prisoner and how something like this does appear to happen all the time. We're going to take a break for the news. We'll come back with your thoughts on this. But immediately after the news, we're going to have an update on the heist of the decade. Suspects have been arrested following the robbery at the Louvre. But first, the headlines with Tim Daly.
The father of one of the victims of the sex offender and asylum seeker mistakenly released from prison on Friday has called the error unbelievably irresponsible. The Justice Secretary says Hadish Kabatu will be deported back to Ethiopia this week after being arrested this morning. Russia has said it successfully tested a nuclear-powered cruise missile, which it claims can pierce any defence shield. The Kremlin's military says it travelled 8,700 miles during a 15-hour flight. And a new survey is claiming the average person has seen no meaningful improvement in their life during Labour's first year in power. 7,000 people were interviewed by the Life in the UK study for the charity Carnegie UK. LBC weather, clear spells followed by scattered showers overnight, particularly in northern and western areas. The winds will increase as well. We'll see a low of around 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
People ask me, what's my good place? Sunday lunch with the whole family. And knowing that because I'm over 55, I can withdraw from my pension pot with a few clicks on the Pension Bee website. Ollie, are you feeding the dog?
No.
At Pension Bee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Go to pensionbee.com and be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk. Withdrawals available from the age of 55, 57 from 2028.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So, more of your thoughts on what's going wrong with the prison system in this country to come. But let's talk about the heist at the Louvre for a moment. Because suspects have been arrested over the robbery of what are called the crown jewels from the Louvre. Let's talk about this with Anne Elizabeth Moutet. Anne is a columnist for The Telegraph based in Paris. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Nick.
Very good to talk to you. It's already one of the most famous heists in history. Do we know how they managed to get into the cases that the jewels were in so very easily?
We know absolutely how that went. It was filmed not by security cameras, because there weren't security cameras, but by people who had come to visit the Louvre that day. And they had a disc cutter, and they attacked the display cases with the disc cutter. These were fairly recent display windows. They were supposed to be made of incredibly strong glass, and the glass may have been strong, so it didn't shatter. But it started breaking into two, and they literally, you could see it in the video, that one of them was pulling apart the two sides of the breech and pulling the jewels out. And one wooden part, it was Empress Eugenie's crown, which means that it was found on the ground later damaged, because They tried desperately, but it didn't work out.
Yeah, and it seemed to be the slowest escape in history, because they climbed into one of those cherry pickers to exit the building, didn't they?
Well, yes and no, because it may look slow when we look at it, but the entire hold-up from, you know, from their pushing the cherry picker and sort of lifting themselves to the first floor window, and when they got back down from the cherry picker, hopped on turbocharged scooters and scooted away, that took 7 minutes.
Amazing. And work was being carried out on the building, of course, which gave the robbers cover to pose as construction staff. Are the Louvre saying that the work on the building actually compromised the security measures that would ordinarily have been in place?
There was no visible work on that part of the building. It is a huge building. It's the largest museum in the world, I think. It used to be a royal palace for half a millennium. It's made of bits and pieces starting in the Middle Ages and going all the way to the 19th century. So it is complex and all that, but it's not unbelievable for somebody in Paris to see people in hazmat coats getting into a building or getting alongside a facade. That was very clever. I mean, it worked very well. They looked perfectly legit, and it took them little time to break into the window with the same dust cutter.
Now, these arrests have come quite quickly. What do we know about those detained?
What we know about those detained is that one of them yesterday night was trying to get onto a plane to Algeria, and another one was arrested in Paris, but he had plans to go to Mali. The guy who wanted to go to Mali is French Malian, and the man who wanted to go to Algeria is a French citizen but of Algerian descent. And I can tell you that the chief investigator of the justice investigator in Paris is absolutely furious, because the Home Secretary, Laurent Nunez, who's been named very, very recently, immediately boasted about making this arrest. He tweeted about it, complimenting the police, and the police was thinking, if you hadn't sort of blown this trumpet so soon, we might have been able to do more. And what this probably means is that they were following them. They found DNA traces into the gallery. They were, you know, on the glass. One of the robbers had been wearing a helmet, like a motorcycle helmet, and he dropped it in the gallery, and they found hairs, and they compared this with files that these people had, because they are, as they, as we say here, known of the police services, and the whole point was to follow them and hope to find the place where they put the loot.
And have the police said anything about the fate of that loot?
We do not know about the fate of that loot. We know that there were two more men, there were four, organizing this. It is now coming out that this was a commission, possibly from a Russian person, and the Russian person can be anybody from the part of the notorious Eastern European treasure robbery gangs. All of that could even be a nice touch from our wonderful friend President Putin.
Now, the jewels were said to...
It is taken seriously.
Well, I imagine. The jewels were said to be worth... they put a price on it. In effect, they're priceless as a made piece. But $102 million is what they said. And presumably, unless it was to go to some arch villain's private collection... then they would have been broken down and still be worth millions as individual jewels. Do you know anything about are the constituent jewels easy to sell, and are those type of gems traceable?
The constituent jewels, you're quite right, are not traceable at all, are very traceable at all, and therefore they're very difficult to sell. Because, first of all, the stones, and those stones some of them are stones that have been used several times. And, for instance, there are diamonds in the crown that were given by Cardinal Mazarin to Louis XIV, and it was used again in the 19th century to make jewelry for Queen Marie-Amélie and Queen Hortense, the sister of Bonaparte. and some of it also for the Empress Eugénie. So we're talking about the descendants of Napoleon and the family of Napoleon. Second, when you cut those stones, even if you prize them from the setting, the cut is 19th century, and therefore it looks very different from today's cut. But most important, these are stones that have inclusions, especially emeralds, the magnificent emerald necklace and earrings and bracelets. And emeralds have got inclusions that are incredibly recognizable and unique. So you'd have to cut them into tiny pieces for them not to be recognizable. So it's very difficult to think that they could be sold.
And what's it like now at the Louvre? Have they taken any measures to increase security? Has it made visiting the museum more difficult?
It's made visiting the museum a bit more difficult because you've got extra people in the galleries. But it's nowhere like, for instance, the Tower of London. Everybody in France was saying, well, how do the British prevent their crown from being stolen? And then you have to tell them about the moat and the dungeon and the concrete case and the security passes. And so far, tourists go into the galleries of the Louvre and they still go and look at pictures. The pictures are guarded sometimes by bulletproof glass like the Mona Lisa. But it's not substantially changed. And the decision, I think, is first of all, again, it's a huge museum, difficult to change immediately. But also, if the experience is that now to get inside the Louvre, it's going to be like getting to the bottom of a gold mine in South Africa someplace, it sort of completely kills off the whole idea of a museum which is meant to be open to the public.
Yeah, what's interesting about the police chase is that there was no CCTV apparently in the Louvre that covered their exit, but the police have been taking footage from private CCTV images, haven't they? People's dash cams and so on, which they managed to piece together as a sort of a jigsaw puzzle to see where these people went.
But yes, because there were five cameras around the Louvre, and five cameras around this huge building is not terribly efficient. And these are police cameras for people who get robbed in the street and sometimes the traffic. You've got that. You've got the cameras of some shops, but that's not a side of the Louvre that has so many shops. It, however, does have apartments that have security systems. So that's also something. The police know how to put this together, and they are aware of the presence of cameras, but there aren't that many of those.
And I suppose it just remains to be decided who's going to play the lead in the blockbuster film. Tom Cruise, Matt Damon, place your bets.
Well, no. I mean, there's no acrobatics in this. They just walked in, seized the stuff and walked out.
Good to talk to you, Anne. That's Anne Elizabeth Moutet, columnist for The Telegraph, based in Paris, talking to us on the phone from there. Now, we're going to take a short break and then come back with your thoughts on what's gone wrong with the prison system, such that hundreds, literally hundreds of prisoners are released mistakenly every year. 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Dither. No one has covered themselves in glory in this.
Potential chairman Jim Gamble saying he's walking away. Despair. Survivor Ellie Ann Reynolds.
It's another way to silence everybody so that the government and the authorities look like they're doing their job, but they're not.
Distress. Survivor Elizabeth.
I don't believe that it is going to go in our favour, and I don't believe that they're up to the job of doing it.
Last week, they all said they'd lost faith in Labour's grooming gangs probe, and as it is being suggested, it won't start until next year. How can the government put right this colossal wrong? Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
With cyber security from BT. Security solutions built for businesses.
Back tomorrow morning from 7, LBC.
Julie could part exchange her car. Or check out We Buy Any Car. She could be unsure if she got a good deal part exchanging. Or have cash in the bank with more bargaining power to get a bigger car for her five-a-side team. Totally played. Or total player. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, get 3 months free. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. New customers starting a policy before the 27th of November. Pay bi-monthly direct debit for the first year. Terms and conditions apply. Over 50s only.
Welcome our new bookworms to the club. Now, do you read traditional books or e-books?
Oh, real books.
Traditional, always.
Yes, quite.
I read e-books. Mm-hmm. I adjust it so the font's huge.
Ooh, they make large font books.
Think bigger. Imagine Moby Dick all cuddled up with a book. His font size.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. Maybe it's time for varifocals. At Specsavers, get 2-for-1 varifocal glasses from £110. Conditions and exclusions apply. See online for details.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So we're talking about the migrant who was accidentally freed from prison, who has now been rearrested following a three-day, well, they call it a hunt, but he wasn't really on the run. He was just sort of wandering around in a what appears to be a confused state, unsure of why he was allowed out. And perhaps the most shocking thing about it is that it's a completely common occurrence. 262 prisoners were released in error this year. 115 last year, 81 the year before, and some really appalling mistakes based on the kind of person that was released. And I mentioned some of those just before I was talking to Anne Elizabeth Moutet about the situation at the Louvre. But what has gone wrong with the prison service that this happens so frequently? And I'd be interested to hear from you if you are either a current or an ex-prison officer as to what the procedure is for somebody's release. Bath. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
May I just pass on my compliments to your producer? It's very diligent, very intelligent young person. Could I just say, just to give you a bit of a background to this, I've got physicians in my family as well as lawyers. My daughter's a barrister, but my cousin used to work in prisons as one of the guards.
Yeah,
him and his wife actually, and he eventually resigned in the end after the unfortunate last discovery of suicide, where it just became too much for him and got little help at all. So they do a very difficult job. I won't go into company names because of the legality of all of it, but I think, do you remember a while ago our probation service was taken back into government ownership because it was farmed out to a second or third party?
Mm.
And it wasn't actually, you know, it diluted the accountability. And now I think some of it has something to do with that. I don't know the full details of the fellow that got let out by accident or whatever, but I just think there are certain things like our water, like infrastructure, like prisons, NHS, whatever, that you can't bring in external private firms to be involved in these things because it just dilutes the accountability. And one of your last callers was talking about drugs coming in via guards, whether it's that or it's drones. But I think in the case of this fellow that got let out, I don't know. I think that's due to overwork. That's due to one hand knowing what not knowing what the other hand's doing. And it's by farming stuff out. I mean, I don't know. From what I can tell from your researcher that and your producer, this particular prison isn't run by a particular company of such. But
yeah, one of the big outsourcers. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's it. But there's an ethos of farming everything off, and the devil in the detail gets lost.
Well, it's quite true. I mean, the things that you've mentioned, you know, water and so on, I mean, they should not be run by private companies because their primary concern is feeding the profits to the shareholders, and that's not what you want really from your water provider or from the prison service or the probation service. Or,
indeed.
Yeah, quite.
But also, look at the American system where prisons have become businesses. Do we really want that? Do we really want someone getting like 200-year prison sentence so they can make license plates forever?
No, absolutely. As with much that happens in America, we wouldn't want to copy their example at all. No, that would be disastrous. And they seem to be moving in that direction. But I think you're right in saying that they've seen the light and have brought the services that they used to farm out back in house.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right. Good talk to you, John. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. Ray says, getting sick of the gaslighting on this case. Basically, the prison service let this man out by mistake. They then went on a massive manhunt, making this the biggest story in UK media. Being utterly inept, the Met begged him to hand himself in, and he just went to a library. It sounds like he was totally confused by this mistake, and yet has become public enemy number one. Yeah, that's right. But you know, the news media does follow its own tail, and because you know, journalists are just as lazy as everybody else, and if one journalist goes big on it, then they say, oh, well, this story has just written itself, because I'll just copy and paste everything that person has just done, and my day is done. I think that is much of what happens in the press, I suspect. Regent's Park. Hello, Vance.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Nick, I had the privilege of being of having a boyhood in Africa, and during all that time, my dad was a director of prisons, first of all in Tanganyika, as it then was, and then in Botswana, and in one or two other countries. And when we came back to England, I well remember my dad complaining about the prisons that he was visiting as a consultant, and complaining that there was no discipline in the prisons anymore in the UK, that there were too few things for prisoners to do, that there was a lack of discipline. And I think that one of the things that is missing nowadays is that sort of sense of routine and discipline and a purpose in prisoners' lives. In fact, when my dad joined the prison service in Africa, the prison service was part of the British military system. Hmm. And military regulations applied throughout the prisons in Africa at that time. And indeed, when my dad retired from the prison service, the pension he got was not a prison service pension, but an army pension. And my dad had brilliant results from the prisons that he ran. Every prisoner had to join, had to take up a work course, an apprenticeship, a pharmaceutical apprenticeship or a car mechanical apprenticeship, so that when they left prison, and they had no choice in this, well, they could choose what sort of apprenticeship, but they had to choose something. And it meant that when they left the prison, they had a guaranteed job to go to.
They had a positive skill rather than being taught by older lags how to thieve more efficiently.
Exactly, Nick. And 10 years after Tanganyika's independence, President Nyerere invited my dad to go back to the country and to fly all over Tanganyika to see for himself what his ex-prisoners had done. And my dad said that in every little village and town that he went to, he found big brass plaques outside workshops and little offices proudly saying, trained in Her Majesty's prison.
Hmm.
That's so telling, isn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds like a better system than we have at the moment, and it all must feed into the thing that made these officers make this mistake in the first place. I mean, it's a lack of training. It's the terrible turnover of staff that they have. They're surrounded by newbies. All the experienced officers are slowly fading away. Much of the staff is now from foreign lands, with all the problems with communication that must involve. You've got your prison population that is seething with anger because they're locked in a tiny cell, which is made for maybe two people, and there's four people in there, and they're I don't know whether those numbers are correct, but I know that the prisons are over full, And they're locked in a cell for 23 hours a day with, you know, all of the consequences in their behaviour that that must bring. And then you've got prison officers who are trying to manage all this on a very low wage, and their morale must be rock bottom. So no wonder mistakes are made so frequently.
Absolutely. And the prison officers can't take pride in their job, because what's there to be proud about?
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody suffers. But I thought you'd like to know that.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks for that, Vance. 0345 6060 973. Liverpool. Hello, Kit.
Hello, my darling. Good morning.
Kit.
Are we dealing with a new, like, switchback? Are we okay with that for now?
Say it again?
Sorry, I spoke to you the other day and we briefly discussed the ridiculousness of the lights going back.
Oh, yes. Well, we're just going to have to suffer through it, I suppose.
We are, I suppose. But listen, on a really far more serious level, the subject came to him now. I just don't get it. I, unfortunately, over the years, have been amongst a huge demographic of people, but I do know lots of people who have been put in prison. And what absolutely befuddled me was how many of them literally did not give a single flu-fla as to whether or not they were going to get put inside. And to the contrary, they went, oh, no, God, I love it. You know, I love it. Because you think of all that, you're not paying any bills, getting all your meals paid for you, meeting loads of people, you're having a laugh, we can still get phones and drugs and whatever in there, you know. Not a problem.
Well, I suppose some people get institutionalised and it becomes easier for them to have all that done for them. But I find it hard to believe that somebody wouldn't mind having their freedom taken away from them.
Well, that's where I'm sorry, I don't agree with you. I think there are loads of people who literally think it is easier being on prison than trying to live outside in the community when you're only earning a minimum, not even earning, when you're being given benefits that don't even get you through the week, so there's no hope, no future. It's literally, it's easier and better to be in prison. But and it's sad, it's so sad. But I just think it would be much better. Okay, there are two categories, right? First of all, it is true, unfortunately, there are certain criminals who are so dangerous, it's not okay to let them into the community.
Yeah.
We know first and foremost that the major problem that we have, and it freaks me out every day, when I read newspapers and read records and read the crimes that have been committed, and then you read it and you go, oh my God. And then you read to the end and they go, but it's a suspended sentence. And you say, well, that's just a free rule for people, isn't it? Why would anybody, even I, right, why would I be afraid of committing a simple crime when I know that literally nobody's ever going to do me for it? Because we haven't got the prison capacity in the same way as we have, and I know it's a different level, but in the same way we haven't got the migrant capacity. I listened to somebody the other day, I can't remember which show it was, which one, it might have been James or Brian or something, I really can't remember, or Nick Abbott or somebody like that.
Yeah, that's me.
Oh, sorry, my
love. Whatever it is you're about to say, I take no responsibility. Go ahead.
Okay, guilty is not charged, Jonah. But the point is, you just put me off then. But the point is, let's change the dynamics of it. Let's change the dynamics. It is absolutely true that because we haven't got a coherent and responsible criminal justice system at the moment, that most people don't give two flu-flars whether or not they're going to go to court and get sentenced.
Yeah, I know you said that already, but I very much doubt that people are not bothered about going to prison. I think maybe you're confusing that with people's willingness to commit crime, but I'd suggest that when you commit a crime, you're doing so not in the expectation of being caught. You expect to get away with it, or it doesn't even cross your mind because it's a spur-of-the-moment thing. But I very much doubt that people, I mean, those that are institutionalised, perhaps, or have a terrible life outside and have become used to being inside, a very few number of them might actually want to be in prison, but I'm not sure that that's a common thought among most people. And they commit crime expecting not to have to suffer the consequences. That's why they do it in the first place. But interesting thoughts there, Kit. Thanks for that. Vivian says the prison service used to be a professional service. They had a lot of training and professionalism and a stricter regime. But since privatisation, the quality of officers has declined and the managers as well. Privatisation has not worked. It needs to be run with more professionalism. Yeah, I don't think the prison service has been privatised. Anne says, a government can't be held responsible for the wrongful release of prisoners. The prison staff are responsible. I'll give you the last word there, Anne. Thanks for that. Now, after the news, Sarah Pochin says she's sorry after hitting out at what are described as woke adverts full of black and Asian people. The Reform MP says it drives her mad that the average white family is no longer represented. That's not quite what she said. She said it drives her mad to see black faces on TV ads. Health Secretary Wes Streeting called her comments racist. Do you think her comments were racist? If so, should she get the sack, or do you agree with some of the things she says? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. The Justice Secretary says the sex offender and asylum seeker Hadish Kabati will be deported in the coming week after being apprehended at a park in North London. The 38-year-old was found this morning after being freed from prison by mistake on Friday. The former Metropolitan Police Detective Shabnam Chowdhury's been talking to Nick Abbott on LBC. She thinks staff at HMP Chelmsford were totally unaware of what was happening.
It would have been helpful if they'd have actually tried to listen to what he was telling them, which was, as I understand it, that he was expected to be deported. He then sought the help of one of the delivery drivers and then was eventually directed towards Chelmsford train station to make his own way, allegedly to the deportation location. Certainly not the actions of a man that was happy to either be released or to escape.
A woman's been raped in the West Midlands in what police are calling a racially aggravated attack. An investigation is underway after officers were sent to Park Hall in Walsall on Saturday evening. West Midlands police say the attack is not being linked with any others. Forecasters are warning a hurricane which is heading for Jamaica could grow to become a Category 5 storm. The weather system, named Melissa, is expected to hit the island on Monday night, bringing rain and wind speeds of around 145 miles per hour. A senior cabinet minister has admitted the UK's public finances are in a challenging state. Wes Streeting made the comments as speculation continues on what will be contained in next month's budget. There are currently suggestions the Chancellor may be considering a mansion tax on the super rich. The Professor of Political Economy, Michael Jacobs, has been telling LBC the UK is reaching an economic turning point.
It has kind of lied to itself, and I do think we're going to have to face the truth, which is if you want good public services, somebody has to pay for them. And in practice, what that means is people on higher incomes, not the, only the very highest incomes, but from middle to high, are almost certainly going to have to pay more in tax.
And officials from the US and China have both claimed a trade deal between the world's two largest economies is drawing closer. Donald Trump is expected to meet Xi Jinping on Thursday in South Korea. LBC weather, clear spells, followed by scattered showers overnight, particularly for northern and western areas. The winds will be strengthening as the night goes on as well. We'll see a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC, from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Reform MP, Sarah Pochin, has apologised for any offence caused after saying, it drives me mad when I see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people. She said her comments were phrased poorly, but insisted that many adverts are unrepresentative of British society. So she phrased it poorly, but it's still the case that it drives her mad when she sees adverts full of black people and full of Asian people, just not in those words. Okay, let's talk about this with Arva Vidal, the comedian and journalist who joins us on the phone now. Hello, Arva.
Hello.
Some people who are attempting to attract the right-wing vote say things they know their intended targets will love and apologise afterwards, having got their message across. Do you think there was a bit of that here to what Potchin said?
I don't think, I think she has got the right-wing vote already. I don't think she needs to sort of go out and try to get it. She's a Reform MP, so I think they've got the right-wing vote sealed.
I mean, if somebody is complaining about the number of black faces on TV adverts, would you assume that it's not actually the adverts that they're complaining about?
I mean, the BBC recently did a survey, and what people came back with was, most of all, they wanted less diversity. So I guess, I mean, it's not something that hasn't been said before. There was a debate on GB News about the same thing.
People wanted less diversity?
Yes, they did.
A study by Ofcom found that, not adverts, but they were monitoring TV programming, and they said that black individuals accounted for 5.7% of faces on TV programming, South Asian 3.2%, mixed race 1.8%, and that it all totaled 11.5%. So about 90% of the faces on TV programming are white British, and that's not enough.
I think people just, the minute they see any kind of black face on TV, there's a group of people that get very upset by it. I think those are, you know, people who are in agreement with her. I think the thing is that Reform have kind of sort of, you know, made a mistake here, because they're trying to say, well, she was trying to clarify, and she said, oh, 4% of Britain is non-white, so why are they on all these adverts and stuff? But, you know, for years, months, you've been saying that we've been taking over the country. So, in a way, she's inadvertently admitted that we're not. So I suppose there's that.
You know, afterwards she said that adverts have gone diversity, equity and inclusion mad, which I suppose you could shorten to the dreaded woke word. But they haven't, though, have they? Because there's underrepresentation of disabled individuals as far as they number in society. There's underrepresentation of older people, of pregnant people, of gay people, and the, you know, the rainbow initialism of LGBT and so on. And she didn't complain about that. So it appears to be less about wokery gone mad, because it hasn't, and it's just more about black people on the telly in her living room.
Well, yeah, she said she specified black and Asian people. It gets her mad to see it.
Channel 4 did a survey a few years ago that found that 51% of TV ads had black faces in them, however. I mean, that is much higher than the 4% that make up the population in England and Wales. So there is an element of truth to the notion that black faces are overrepresented in adverts compared to the general population.
Well, I mean, the middle-class people are overrepresented in adverts, and then cities are overrepresented in adverts. And if you're talking about cities, then they're going to have more diverse population. So, you know, it's rarely some village in the middle of Yorkshire that's represented in an advert.
Yeah, but seeing a black face in a 30-second ad in between a programme that is all white, or not, at least 90% white, and then complaining about it, it seems a bit, I don't know, extreme.
I know, but I mean, that's what's been going on politically. It's been, they're taking over, you know, with our country. That has been what has been said by people like Reform. So this is just an extension of that, really.
Do you think that, because that is quite a high number, 50% of ads have a black face in them. Do you think that advertisers sense that adverts, up till recently, have usually been totally white, and they have perhaps tried too hard to redress the balance?
I don't think they've tried too hard at all. I mean, not all the adverts are made by the same people. So I don't think that's what the situation is.
In some senses, it's tokenism, isn't it? Because the black faces that Potchin was complaining about don't dominate an ad. They just may be part of a montage of images, which could be, and probably are, dominated by white people with fleeting glimpses of black faces to maybe tick a box.
I don't know that it, well, you know, I could argue that to tick a box, but I don't think so. I think if you're going to advertise something like bread or beer or whatever, you might want everyone to drink it, so you're just going to put different faces in it. I don't think it's a problem. Well, it's not for me. Obviously, it's for her.
And has this willingness to include non-white faces on screen been echoed in the makeup of the staff who actually make the ads and who are running television? Because that seems unlikely.
Well, that would be where I'd like to see more black faces behind the cameras. You know, when you do a TV show, the production team has very rarely got many black people on it. And if they are, they might be runners, possibly researchers. Anything that I've done, I've, you know, you walk along and you might be on commentating or something and you don't see another black person there.
Is it maybe an age thing? Like, Reform voters are mostly 50-plus. They might object to seeing a non-white face, but young people, they don't. And young people are who advertisers want. They don't really advertise to older people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit of a fallacy. I think Reform have got plenty of young voters, and that's, you know, people keep saying, oh, this attitude's dying out, it's all getting better, but actually it's not. Because they've really appealed to young people, saying, hey, it's your country, look around, you've got nothing, they're taking everything from you. So I don't think it's that.
OK, good to talk to you, Ava. Thanks for that. Ava Vidal, the comedian and journalist, talking about what Sarah Potchin, the Reform MP, had said about adverts full of black people. What do you make of this? 0345 6060 973. East Yorkshire, hello, Mike.
Evening, Nick. Yeah. I wonder just how valuable is Sarah Potchin to Farage, because her initial outburst, not this one, think back, she was saying that she wanted the niqab and the burqa ban, and that resulted in the Reform chairman resigning. He was prepared to come back as some technical policy chief or whatever. But she wasn't disciplined. She's done it again now. She's come out with this stuff. And no consequences.
But I would imagine that your Reform voter, your average Reform voter, would absolutely love what she said.
I'm sure that they would. But you have to take a bigger picture on this and look at what she actually said. I mean, she's subsequently come back. I mean, technically, she was correct that black people are overrepresented on adverts.
Mm. But she didn't say that, though. She said it makes her mad to see it.
Yes, but technically she said there weren't enough white people, so she was implying there was an imbalance. But look at what Reform stands for. They stand for free marketeering, capitalism. Well, what is more capital than advertising?
Yes.
Pay for these things. If it didn't work, they wouldn't pay for them. So she's saying that these people are overrepresented, and it makes her sick that these people are overrepresented. But it's capitalism. Well, what is Reform for capitalism, or are they saying, no, we have to be technically correct with how adverts are constructed? It all makes no sense, but why are they defending this? I mean, Chris Philp went on telly this morning. Two interviews. One, he said, no, this wasn't racist. The next interview he did, he said, this was racist. Even he can't make his mind up whether it's racist or not, or he maybe changed his mind whether it was good politics to say one or the other.
Well, you could not locate my interest in what Chris Philps says with an electron microscope, but I think you were right when you said that it's about business. It's about making money. And the evidence does suggest, and Oxford University did a study about this, they said that the inclusive campaigns, those with, you know, like a rainbow of faces, like a Benetton ad, delivered a 16.2% uplift in long-term sales. It made people 62% more likely to buy that product as a first choice and 23% less likely to drop that product after they'd trialed it. So, I mean, that does rather suggest that woke ads work.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the point I'm getting to, that what are Reform trying to do? They're trying to motivate people in a certain direction. When if people stopped and thought about it, it doesn't actually make sense. You have to come out, at the end of the day, taking big decisions, you either have to decide, I want to be civilised, or you have to decide, I want to be primitive. And reform... And that is a big truth. Think of Bronowski, he sent a man. He was loading people becoming more civilised. What are reform and their ilk, Trump, trying to do? They're trying to take us back to primitive behaviours.
Right.
It's really bizarre. Think about it. When you have a big decision to make, am I going to make a civilised one or a primitive one, and the world would be a better place, mate?
Yeah, maybe Nigel Farage should touch the obelisk. thanks a lot, Mike. 0345 6060 973. Do you think that Sarah Potchin actually had a point, or is she just dog whistling to the cult fans of reform? 0345 6060 973. LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why is there delay?
Straight to the point.
This government is unravelling everywhere you look.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How can that make sense to anyone?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Trains are three bridges for two adults, one skeleton and one fairy werewolf, as you do.
Just one pumped in each, kids. Charlie, not that one, mate. It's nearly as big as you.
Back on the train with two little monsters and a couple of pumpkins. Now off home to spend a good 3 hours carving. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we're talking about the Reform MP Sarah Potchin, who has, I don't know, was it an apology? Like, sorry, not sorry. She's apologised for any offence caused, right, after saying, "It drives me mad when I see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people." Well, remarkable that somebody could say that on television, thinking that it wouldn't cause offence, and only thought about it later and thought, oh, yeah, you know what? Sorry about that. She said her comments were phrased poorly, but insisted that many adverts are unrepresentative of British society. Well, that's true. But why do adverts have to be representative of British society? They're just companies trying to sell their goods. You know, it's not a social experiment that these companies are engaged in. It's naked consumerism is what they want. They want people to buy their goods, and they've determined that the best way to do it is to present their goods in whatever fashion they do. But what's that going to do with a Reform MP? The MP said the viewer she was responding to some viewer who had brought this up, and she said, "It drives me mad when I see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people. It doesn't reflect our society, and I feel that your average white person, average white family, is not represented anymore." Well, they are. It's at least half of the faces that you see on TV adverts. But moreover, TV adverts only take up a tiny part of your viewing pleasure. Mostly what you watch is the TV programmes, and they feature practically no faces that aren't white at all. It's 90% white in the TV programmes. Now, if an advert break is about 3 minutes in a half-hour show, then that's 10% of your viewing half-hour. And it can't be that all adverts in that break feature black faces. So she's talking about a tiny percentage of what she sees on TV, but that's the thing that she chose to complain about. And then said, sorry for any offence. Okay. 0345 6060 973. It is actually not the first time I've heard that people say, you know, got so many black faces on adverts on television, as though that really makes any difference. I mean, if it bothers you, then make a little note about the about which companies are advertising like that and choose not to buy their product, if it really upsets you that much. 0345 6060 973.
Sleaford. Hello, Sam. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, I do think that it's racist what she said. And our country, we have all different cultures and people within this country and disabilities, like you said. So there should be a more rounded, you know, type of people on adverts, on TV programmes, etc. And for people that, you know, if you constantly see the stereotypical English person on TV, for those of us that aren't, it's, you know, it's a bit upsetting as well. We could say, oh, you know, just like she said, I'm sick of that too. And also, you never see disabled people on adverts. For example, my daughter's autistic. Do you ever see an autistic person on adverts? Probably not. So we could all go on about that. But I think that it should be a rounded, you know, everybody, different people. And I think she's very racist and, you know.
Okay. Thanks for that, Sam. 0345 6060 973. The TV company Channel 4, they released a study called Mirror on the Industry. They found that over half of UK television adverts, this was back in 2022, I assume it's more or less the same. You know what? I don't watch TV ads. I can't believe anybody does anymore. I zip through them at 30 times normal speed. Doesn't everybody? You sit there and watch the ads? Why? It seems like so last decade. But anyway, TV ads in 2022, about half featured black people. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they dominated the screen. They could have been in the background. There could have been a montage of people. It could have been, you know, like a party scene where one black face happened to appear. But in about half of UK adverts, a black face appeared. About 17% South Asian individual appeared. 4% had disabled people. Now, disabled people make up about 18% of the population, so they are very underrepresented. As are older people. You just don't see old people in TV ads. Yet, look around, they're everywhere. Pregnant people, pregnant women, almost never appear in a TV ad. And representations of gay people and, you know, the LGBT and all, et cetera and so on, they're featured in about 2% of adverts, which is also an underrepresentation. About 80% of people in the UK are white, and that is more or less what you get as represented on adverts. So her fundamental argument that adverts misrepresent British society is not true, and it's very much not true, underlined and in bold, in areas where a lot of people congregate, by which I mean cities. You know, if you talked about London, then white people are overrepresented in TV adverts. Barnett, hello, Michael.
Hi there, great show. And as I was saying to your researcher, it can come across as being racist, but I don't think she meant it to be racist, personally, because it's just flippant talking. And unfortunately, a lot of people can quite easily be easily offended.
Well, let me read you what she said. I'll just read one line. It drives me mad when I see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people.
Yeah, I sometimes feel that way. You're right. In sometimes, not everything, but now and again, you think, like on the London Underground, if you've been on there lately, almost every single advert being advertised on how to use the tube, how to do this, that, and whatever, are primarily Muslim, Indian, primarily women, not many men, it's all women, of multicultural, but virtually no white English women, shall we say.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't travelled on the tube in a long while. I try to avoid it as much as possible. But
Yeah.
Are you perhaps not just noticing those faces because they're not what you expect?
No, not in the least at all. Because I am not of English descent. I'm an immigrant, as you call it. I've been born in the UK. I've been here since I was 4 years old. I'm now 60. I do refer to myself being English British, but I am not, as they, shall we say, English white. No. But I have most of my friends are all of ethnic colours, because we're not racist. You know, I don't even see, I see people and I talk to people who they are, not because they're LGBT or because they're black or because they're white.
Yeah, I get that, but I just suspect that some people notice it because they hadn't noticed it before. I can remember a couple of Christmases ago. There was a black family presented as one of the supermarkets TV Christmas campaign, and it was they were all having the typical Christmas ad. They're all around a table groaning with food, and they happened to be a black family, and the furore that came from that, people wanted to boycott the supermarket, and it was just insane what people would how people reacted to it.
Well, that is pathetic,
and it is because they'd never seen it before.
For me, that doesn't bother me. I mean, I don't mean one advert, but when you see streams of adverts, like I said on the tube, it's like, especially the Mayor of London adverts, and also, as I also picked up, which is mentioned, he refers to London being misrepresented because he says it's not white faces. And that, for me, I thought that was sort of racist to white people, but no one ever picks that up. Why is that? Why does he go around being very racist about being anti-white, but nobody ever picks him up?
Who are you talking about?
Our Mayor of London.
Oh. The Mayor of London said that...
He said, we are misrepresented and white faces do not represent London.
Well, white faces don't represent London. A mixture of faces represent London. White faces are about 50%, something like that.
Yeah, I agree.
Right.
But the fact he specifies white faces do not. And he didn't specify a mixture of faces, but he just said white faces don't.
Right, well, I think the point that, I don't know precisely what it was that you're referring to, what he said, but I'm assuming that what he meant was all white faces. If there's a poster of all white people, that they would not represent London, which is just fundamentally true. But that's an interesting take on it. Thank you, Michael. 0345-6060-973. North Ayrshire. Hello, Joe.
Oh, hi there, Nick. Hi. So I think we can sort of say that Sarah Poachin is basically saying it drives her mad when she sees black and Asian people. That's kind of like the slightly shortened version.
Yeah,
of
that's
it.
What,
does that sound
what,
right?
what she said on TV. When I say adverts full of black, full of Asian people, yeah.
So I think we can shorten that to it drives her mad to see black and Asian people, basically.
Well, that may be an inference that you make. Okay. I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay, that's fair enough. So I don't know if you can help me out here. Help me make this make sense, because she and her Brexity co-conspirators dragged us out of the European Union, which, of course, is, mostly white. I mean, pretty much completely white.
Mm-hmm.
It's whiter than the UK is. Perhaps
forcing all of those white Eastern Europeans to leave to be replaced by people from India and Pakistan, which is probably the opposite of what was promised.
It's a complete opposite of what they promised. I mean, obviously, it was all sold in a lie anyway, because they had those pictures, the famous poster that Nigel Farage did by, that didn't even have Europeans in it. They weren't European people in it.
Right.
They were all brown faces.
They weren't delivering facts, they were delivering feelings.
Well, absolutely. But they, like I said, they ripped us out of the European Union. We had white Europeans coming over here, working, doing jobs that either we couldn't do or didn't want to do. They didn't need to have British passports. They could go back home afterwards. They could come here and work for a few months, pick fruit or work in the food factories or whatever, go back home again. They didn't need British passports or anything like that. They didn't need to bring their families with them. They ripped us out of that arrangement. And surprise, surprise, those jobs have to be filled by somebody else. And they are being filled by black and Asian people. Mm. And she seems surprised. I mean, was she dropped on her head as a baby? You know, what on earth did she think? What did they all think? What did these Brexiters think was going to happen?
I'm not sure that thinking was uppermost in their to-do list. It was about feelings. Just leave it with us and we'll solve all of your problems. And just enough people said, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that.
I mean, she sounds surprised at the mess that her and her Brexity co-conspirators made. They did it. That's what they did. Well, and she's complaining about the results of her actions.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is Nigel Farage's fundamental policy to get us out of the EU. It's his life's work, and absolutely the opposite of everything that he promised would happen, happened. Thanks, Joe. More of your calls on this to come. We're going to take a break for the news. And after the news, supermarkets have warned the Chancellor that tax hikes on them could force them to put their food prices up for us. We're going to hear from a former head of the UK government's economic service on that after the headlines with Tim Daly.
The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, says the sex offender and asylum seeker Hadush Kabatu will be deported in the coming week after being apprehended in North London this morning. The 38-year-old was found after being freed from prison by mistake on Friday. A senior cabinet minister has admitted the UK's public finances are in a challenging state. Wes Streeting made the comments as speculation continues on what will be contained in next month's budget. And forecasters are warning a hurricane heading for Jamaica could grow to become a Category 5 storm. The weather system, named Melissa, is expected to hit the island on Monday night. LBC weather, clear spells followed by scattered showers overnight, particularly for northern and western areas. There'll be strong winds and possibly gales on western coasts, and we'll see a low of around 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like saving £28 on this week's Big Shop when you switch to Lidl Plus from Tesco Club Card. See the shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Lidl, more to value. 18+ GB only. Offer ends 5th of 11th, 25. Price check, 20th of 10th, 25. And pro-rata based on size. Tesco also sell other products. Excludes multi-buys, T's and C's apply.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Welcome our new bookworms to the club. Now, do you read traditional books or e-books?
Oh, real books.
Traditional, always.
Yes, quite.
I read e-books. Oh, yes. I adjust it so the font's huge.
Ooh, they make large font books.
Think bigger. Imagine Moby Dick all cuddled up with a book. His font size.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
Maybe it's time for varifocals. At Specsavers, get 2-for-1 varifocal glasses from £110. Conditions and exclusions apply. See online for details.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
The UK's largest supermarkets are calling on the Chancellor to exclude stores from a new business rates surtax, and they warn that shoppers will bear the brunt of higher prices as a consequence of that. The major supermarkets are among stores that have signed a letter addressed to Rachel Reeves saying that easing taxes on grocers would help curb food inflation. Let's talk about this with Vicky Price. Vicky is Chief Economics Advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business Research and former head of the UK's Government and Economic Service. Good evening, Vicky.
Good evening.
What do you make of this plan?
Well, I think they are concerned because, of course, what is going on, and we're going to see the announcement in the budget at the end of November, is that there is redistribution which is going to take place in terms of business rates, real concern about small firms being negatively affected right now because of the way in which the regime works. And the intention, I think, is that the larger premises, business premises, which will include probably supermarkets, and I think they want to get some clarification of that, are going to have to pay a little bit more with this surtax. And I think the concerns of the supermarkets are that given that their margins are quite low at present, and given that they've got also the issue of the national insurance contributions increase, which has meant that their costs have increased too in terms of employing people and all the other pressures that are out there, this is all going to be translated into higher prices for the consumer. And I think they're making the case that let's be careful about how much we increase taxes on all of us. And that, of course, is, I think, the main thesis in the note that they have sent. And you can understand it up to a point, because you can add to that, of course, the fact that food prices are increasing anyway, the supply chain issues, and also, you know, the inputs, commodities are going up in terms of costs, fertilizers, a lot. For the agricultural sector, and then you have extra packaging requirements which are going to be imposed. In fact, they have started being imposed, or should have started being imposed as of October, which add to costs as well.
Yeah, you said that smaller businesses are going to be impacted, but I thought it was the other way around. I thought that the idea was to tax these larger companies. Then the idea, as we understand it, is that large shops will be included in the government's proposed surtax on properties valued at more than £500,000. Smaller companies won't be in that category, will they? And they are expected to benefit from reduced business rates under the government's plans. That sounds like a good idea, no?
No, absolutely. I thought I did say that. I said that what is going on is a redistribution. So cost lowering for the small firms and increasing possibly for the larger ones. But even for the larger ones, they are looking at lowering the multipliers that they use for anything over 500,000 from 26, 27, which really means that they're not going to be going up as fast as they would have done otherwise. So they are reforming the system anyway, at least that's the intention. But no, you're absolutely right. So the whole issue is that the largest supermarkets are worried that a lot of the cost is going to go onto them, even though there are some concessions given to them as well. And of course, the business properties that the government is looking at include, of course, big warehouses and things like that. And they worry that the big supermarkets, which actually already pay a very large share of business rates, are going to be disproportionately affected by the changes that are taking place.
It seems that supermarkets are always saying this. They're always saying the same thing, whether it's higher national insurance, higher minimum wage, higher business rates. They regret that taxing their vast profits will only hurt us. It sounds to me like they protest too much.
Well, there is an element of that, I suppose, because if you look at what all those various supermarkets have done in terms of profits, they've done rather well just in the last year. And if you look at some of the revisions that have been made for what may be the case in 2025, we've seen quite a re-evaluation of what those profits might be. We fed it actually from a number of them. Tesco had very good results, which came out earlier in the summer. We've got, of course, Lidl also complaining about the same things, but actually seeing profits increasing quite significantly over the previous year. So you could think that, you know, perhaps that's a bit of an exaggeration in terms of what the impact will be. But what I think they're saying is that in order to keep customers coming, they have to make up for the fact that particularly food prices are increasing quite significantly by promotions, cutting all sorts of other things that they sell in their shops, and that their margins remain quite low. So I think that is an issue for the consumer, who has, of course, seen prices indeed go up in supermarkets in the last couple of years, really, particularly. So, you know, it's completely acceptable to say that, look, you're making big profits, and therefore, what are you complaining about? But also, you do worry that if those profits are affected in any way, they will make up for it by increasing prices. And I think that's the point they're making.
Yeah, well, the chief executive of the British Retail Consortium says that supermarkets are helping us by doing everything they can to keep food costs down. Now, you mentioned that their profits have just gone up, but you didn't put a number on it. The top five supermarkets posted a 97% increase in profits to April last year. That doesn't sound like they're doing everything they can to keep prices down.
Yes, you may argue that, but of course it all depends on what the consumer does. I mean, they go and buy more things maybe in the supermarket instead of eating out. So the consumer has changed their habits, and of course they also provide quite a lot of extra things that they do sell, such as clothes, for example, and lots of people are going to supermarkets to buy even the sort of uniforms for their kids for school, whereas before you might have gone somewhere else. So they are widening the offering that they have, and in those areas they do give quite a lot of discounts to attract people who then, of course, go and buy other things, and therefore the profits do better. So, yes, they have ways of getting the customer in, and once they do, they've got them.
It would be a rebalancing, though, wouldn't it? Because the supermarkets have laid waste to the high street, which pretty much doesn't exist as it used to, because people just don't go there, because the supermarkets, with their vast buying power, can undercut local, smaller businesses. And you could say the same on steroids for the for companies like Amazon, who would also come under this tax increase, proposed surtax. It would, if the supermarkets did, as they are threatening to increase prices, then it would actually make the smaller businesses, put them in the position of being able to compete on more level terms.
But that's quite interesting. I mean, what has been happening is that the big supermarkets have also, of course, gone into, quite a big expansion by setting up and opening stores, which are, express stores or mini whatevers. And they are killing, or have killed, to a significant extent, the corner shop that existed before. And there has been quite a lot written about this. Now, the question is, if those smaller firms, smaller food outlets, have already been disadvantaged quite considerably. How many have you got left which can really take advantage of what you've just described, which makes sense in theory, but may in fact not happen in practice?
Well, just because small companies have gone out of business doesn't mean to say that other ones can flourish in their wake. Businesses close all the time and are replaced, surely.
Indeed, and I think we do want vibrant high streets, there's no doubt about that, and we've seen so many shops close, which is a real worry in many places, and of course, you could add banks and everything else that have gone, and quite a lot of premises then stay open, or are changed into coffee shops. So I think there is a rejuvenation of the high street we absolutely need to be looking at, and those smaller shops are important. I think one of the reasons why they've been arguing for this change in the way in which business rates are calculated and getting themselves a discount, which perhaps becomes permanent, which with a bit of luck it might do, is precisely because of that, because they're seeing their prospects diminish quite significantly. And I think for all of us, of course, having a buoyant high street is good news.
You mentioned the low profit margins on individual goods. Of course, it's a unique business as a supermarket because we don't really buy as many products from any other organisation, any other business, as we do in a supermarket. So low margins on many goods can still make vast profits. And is not the cutthroat nature of the grocery sector itself going to keep prices down, because they're all in competition, in desperate competition with each other to get footfall, and so that in itself will work in the consumer's favour, unless there is some sort of agreement between them to match each other's price rises.
But of course we do know the John Lewis motto, which was about not being sort of knowingly undersold, and that they've reinstated it in order to keep their customers so they wouldn't go somewhere else. But it's interesting because quite a lot of customers have quite a lot of allegiance to particular brands or particular supermarket brands. So you see what happened with Marks & Spencer. People did go back after the whole cybersecurity alert that was closing the ability to access anything online. And others are attracting customers through their loyalty cards and everything else. So you do see that there is a bit of customer loyalty that takes place, but you're quite right. I mean, what they depend on, even though the margins might be low, is footfall. Loads and loads of people going into those shops and buying all these things that we were discussing earlier, not just food. That's how they make their profits, even if their margins are low. But it is absolutely true, if you look across the sector, certainly for the big supermarkets, that retail margins are about 3 to 4%, which are quite low by comparison to any other business.
Yeah, but as I said, we don't buy as much from any other business, though, do we? So it actually ends up in their favour, even though they seem to be pleading for special favours from the Chancellor. I mean, they're arguing that easing taxes on grocers would help curb food inflation. Wouldn't if they were actually really concerned about food inflation, that they could solve it in a trice? If supermarkets were that worried about the cost of food in their shops, they could just accept making less profit. But they wouldn't even recognise that as a possibility, would they?
Well, you could say that for all sorts of sectors in the economy. You could say that about the banking sector, for example. You know, a number of the banks have just announced sort of super profits again. So there is indeed that element of needing to make profits and pay the dividends to your shareholders. And a lot of the shareholders, of course, are all of us through our pension funds. So that were the things that we put aside anyway, with a bit of luck for our pensions. So you've got to bear that in mind as well. And of course, what you don't want is loss-making ones, which then have serious problems in the future. But what you also don't want is for supermarkets to start paying the suppliers a lot less and possibly even underpaying them. And we've seen a lot of complaints, you know, through the years of you know, farmers and agricultural outlets saying that they are not getting enough from those supermarkets, from those shops, to cover their costs, and their costs have gone up as well.
Well, yes, quite, but that sort of underlines what I've just said, that the supermarkets will either charge us more or pay less to their suppliers. But there is a third option. There's actually be a responsible business and not chase profits at all costs.
Well, what you've seen, actually, if you separate what's been happening in supermarkets between food and non-food prices, what you've seen is that non-food prices for a large part of the last year have been declining. So year on year, actually negative. They've gone up a little bit recently, but not much. And you also find that they do go up and down depending on the season that you're in. So, you know, quite a lot of discounts are being given at various stages. So it's not, you know, profits across all areas. So they do, in fact, balance things out. But what we do not want them to do, certainly, is not paying suppliers sufficiently to continue to produce the goods that we absolutely need to have for food in the economy. But you need sort of a decent price. But what I think they are concerned is that if you put all those taxes together that are happening now, which are additional to everything else we've seen before, including, of course, you know, the national insurance contributions, the new packaging tax that's coming on, this business rate changes, we might find that, you know, in a number of cases, the ability to then do those discounts in the areas that we'd like them to isn't going to be that great.
Well, you know, Tesco's, for instance, just upgraded its adjusted operating profit for the year 25 to 26, £3.1 billion. I think they can afford it.
Well, I think you can tell them, but they seem to be rather worried about, you know, what may happen next. And, of course, the consumer is already hit by all sorts of other costs, and they may not be able to necessarily respond positively to any price increases which the supermarkets might put. But, you know, you've got a point, and those points have been made about their profits.
Can you put yourself in the position of the Chancellor, though? Because every time she suggests taxing somebody who would count as the 1%, then the fury, the pushing back is enormous. So where should she tax in order to go some way to balancing the books?
Well, the reality is that if you just do this piecemeal sort of tax changes, which take a little bit of time to have an impact in terms of seeing exactly, you know, how the supermarkets then react. Will it be good? Will it be bad? The type of discussion we've just been having. Or, let's say, put a sort of wealth tax on people and wait and see what may happen. All these things have an uncertain outcome at the end of the day. You don't know exactly how much you may be raising. The easiest thing is raising income tax or reversing what Jeremy Hunt did, which was the substantial cut in national insurance contributions for employees, which gave everyone £10 billion in their pocket in January 2024 and then another £10 billion in April 2024, just before the election. And yet Labour said they weren't going to do anything like increasing any of national insurance contribution rates. Back again, and or income tax. So now it's quite clear that the easiest way to raise anything at all is by just raising income tax on national insurance contributions, by putting the rates up. And I think people are warming up to the idea, if you like. It's fairer in many ways, and it is much more certain for the Chancellor. So you asked what one would advise the Chancellor to do. I would say careful about tinkering with what the tax regime is looking like now, particularly on business, and raise income tax, which is perhaps the surest and easiest way of plugging the gap that they have.
Well, easiest, sure, but you said fairest, surely not.
Well, it is fair in the sense that it is it's a tax where, you know, people pay more as they get richer. Really?
Apart from the very richest, who don't make their money through income, they make it through the appreciation in the value of their assets, and that's taxed at much less as a percentage than income, than proper work.
Yes, well, of course, you know, there's tax on savings, there's tax on dividends. Perhaps one doesn't pay national insurance contributions. You could extend that, so you can actually tax a much greater percentage of what comes into people than you do at present.
Okay, good to talk to you, Vicky. Thanks for that. Vicky Price, Chief Economics Advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business Research, former head of the UK's Government Economic Service. And just to put it into perspective, these supermarkets that are saying that, you know, if the Chancellor is so impertinent as to ask them to pay a little bit more tax, they will be forced to hurt us by putting up their prices. I'm not sure that's true. Lidl this month reported pre-tax profits that tripled to £156 million from a year earlier. Their CEO is paid £1.5 million a year. Aldi, operating profits £435 million. Their highest paid director gets £2.2 million a year. Sainsbury's reported retail underlying operating profit of over £1,000 million. Its CEO is paid £5.1 million a year. Marks & Spencer, their annual report this year showed a group profit before tax of £875 million. Their CEO is paid £7.1 million a year. Tesco, their operating profit for the year, £3.1 billion. The company continues with a £1.45 billion share buyback program, the results of which increases the value of the shares, which probably unlocks a bonus for the CEO, who is paid £9.23 million. So there is another choice. They could just choose to make less money, but that is not part of their thinking. 0345 6060 973. We were talking about adverts and Sarah Potchin, her... well, I suppose you could call it an outburst. She said that it makes her mad to see black and Asian, to see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people. And your thoughts on that after this break. This is LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Dither. No one has covered themselves in glory in this.
Potential chairman Jim Gamble saying he's walking away. Despair. Survivor Ellie Ann Reynolds.
It's another way to silence everybody so that the government and the authorities look like they're doing the job, but they're not.
Distress. Survivor Elizabeth.
I don't believe that it is going to go in our favour, and I don't believe that they looked to the job of doing it.
Last week, they all said they'd lost faith in Labour's grooming gangs probe, and as it is being suggested, it won't start until next year. How can the government put right this colossal wrong?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
With cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses.
Back tomorrow morning from 7, LBC.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
Get next summer sorted. Book a Jet 2 holiday now and take your pick of our best rooms, flights and hotels. You'll get 22 kilograms of baggage included. And right now, there's £120 off per couple with My Jet 2. Book now with just a £60 deposit per person and lock in the price for next summer. Jet 2 holidays. Package holidays you can trust. Up to national protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
I like my private details on a need-to-know basis. In other words, I need to know them and you don't. That's why I use Bitdefender whenever I'm connected, working tirelessly in the background to protect me across all my devices, keeping my digital identity confidential, on the down low, on the hush-hush, trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
So we were talking before about Sarah Potchin, the Reform MP, who said on television that it drives me mad when I see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people. She said, it doesn't reflect our society. Well, it very much depends where you live, though, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't reflect the society in Clapton, but it does reflect society in London, or any of the major metropolises in this country. So I guess it it depends on your standpoint and where you happen to be living at the time. But you think this was, it was brought to her attention that it might not be quite the right thing to say. She apologised, kind of. She apologised if you took offence at what she said, but then underlined that she kind of meant it. What do you make of that? Tooting. Hello, Sarah.
Oh, hi, Nick. Yeah, I think it's terrible what she said. I just think these days now it seems to be fashionable to be racist. I mean, it follows on from Robert Jenowick's comments about not seeing a white face in Handsworth. And you just think, why should a person's skin colour bother somebody? I think there's some sinister things going on as well. I mean, adverts portray aspiration. And I'm sure if the black and Asian faces are stereotyped to be criminals, she probably would be happy. But
Well, she probably wouldn't notice because we're very used to that.
This is it. This is the thing. And I think because the images are positive and showing black and Asian people in a positive light, that it's speaking to this, I don't know if it's jealousy or what, or this whole superiority thing that's happening at the moment. But yeah, it's sad to see that people are worried about skin colour.
I think it's also partly that it's increased in number relatively recently. It went from about 30-odd% of adverts featured a non-white face, and then the Black Lives Matter movement started, and then it increased dramatically just afterwards. So it might be just that they're noticing it more, whereas previously it had not occurred to them that they were seeing any non-white faces in adverts, and now they're seeing them quite a bit, and that is, it's kicked in their fear of the other.
Yeah, I agree with you, definitely. And also, if you see more faces, you empathise with them, and then also you aspire to be people that you see on TV. So if you're seeing a managerial post on TV, you're more likely to potentially apply for that post. So I do think it's that stereotype of having positive portrayals of black people on TV. I mean, black people have been in this country for time immemorial, since Roman days. And I think if we teach proper history, that, you know, Black British people have been here for a long time, I think things might change. But we don't really, we have holes in our history. We don't know about, say, John Blank, the trumpeter of Henry VIII back in the day, or Cheddar Man. You know, Black people have been here for a long time.
Yeah. So, all right. Okay, thanks, Sarah. And the thing is that, you know, it is about money. I mean, advertisers and companies who pay companies to make adverts for them, they aren't really interested in trying to improve the social fabric of the nation. They just want the money. And we know that inclusive ads work. You know, most famously, there was the thing in America with the beer. Gun-toting, red-hat-wearing yeehaws in America thought an advert for their favourite beer emasculated them somehow, and so they briefly boycotted the brand for a bit before they forgot about it and went back to drinking it. And then you heard the phrase, go woke, go broke, as though it was some sort of settled economic fact. Well, there's lots of companies that have gone woke and have made a boatload of money by doing it. Maltesers broke ground with campaigns casting disabled actors in everyday situations. The brand Dove built a 20-year platform on challenging beauty stereotypes. Apple regularly highlights accessibility features in its devices. Arla Foods adopted its marketing to reflect Muslim families celebrating Ramadan. Sales went up. As representation went up, these brands didn't drop in diverse faces. They told authentic stories about real life, and the audiences rewarded them with money, which is what it's all about. Thanks for all your calls on that subject. We're going to change it up after the news. Therapists are being urged to prescribe having a job as a form of treatment for patients struggling with their mental health. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says employment should be viewed as just as vital to health as diet and exercise. This comes as the government attempts to tackle the sick note culture, as it's called, as more than 2.8 million people of working age are out of work due to long-term illness. Is it good advice for people struggling with their mental health to get a job, or is it insensitive to urge them to get back to work? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. The father of Hadush Kabatu's teenage victim says he was infuriated by the accidental release of the sex offender and asylum seeker from prison. The 38-year-old Ethiopian disappeared on Friday before being arrested in North London on Sunday morning. He was sentenced to 12 months in September for sexually assaulting a woman in Essex along with a 14-year-old girl. The Epping Forest councillor, Shane Yerrill, has been reading out a statement from her father.
I hope he will be deported immediately, as the longer he was roaming the streets, the more threat he posed to women and children of this country. If anything had happened to another child or female, then that would have been on the heads of HMP Chelmsford, as well as the police and the justice system and our Labour government, for allowing this sexual predator and illegal immigrant back onto the streets from no one else's mistake but their own.
Data from the main nursing union is showing a large rise in members suffering racial abuse and discrimination at work. The Royal College of Nursing says some of the perpetrators could have been emboldened by racist disorder and anti-migrant protest during the summer. Its general secretary is now calling on employers to prioritise tackling racism. Forecasters in the Caribbean are warning a hurricane which is heading for Jamaica could grow to become a Category 5 storm. The weather system, named Melissa, is due to hit the island on Monday night, bringing rain and wind speeds of around 145 miles per hour. The Jamaican government minister, Daryl Vaz, has been warning this hurricane will be different to more recent ones.
We are due to get a direct hit, Category 4 and possibly Category 5. So the level of damage that you saw in Beryl will likely be severely increased and more widespread than what we had.
A new survey is claiming the average person has seen no meaningful improvement in their life during Labour's first year in power. 7,000 people were interviewed by the Life in the UK study from the charity Carnegie UK. It says it's found stagnating well-being and persistent economic hardship for millions since 2023. And the actor Tony Adams has died at the age of 84. He was probably best known for starring as the accountant Adam Chance, in the ITV soap Crossroads. LBC weather, clear spells, followed by scattered showers overnight, particularly for northern and western areas. The winds will strengthen as well. We'll see a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Britons suffering from anxiety or depression are going to be told by therapists that work is good for their mental health. This is under a new government initiative in which therapists will be urged to effectively prescribe having a job as a form of treatment. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said the move reflected a shift in attitude to treating employment as being just as vital to health as diet and exercise. Let's talk about this with Lucy Beresford. Lucy is a psychotherapist and broadcaster and joins us on the line now. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Nick.
Does this sound a bit like the therapy of buck your ideas up?
Pull yourself together, man. Not really, because it actually, philosophically and psychologically, I think it's really onto something. It really recognises not just the dignity of work, but the way in which work provides three really crucial things in our life. It provides structure of whatever that form might be, whether it's having to get up at a particular time or having to be in a certain place at a certain time or meet a certain deadline. It also gives a sense of purpose, and we know from research that particularly if your mental health is being severely compromised by anxiety or depression, both of those things can be very seriously affected by feeling like you don't have a purpose in life, that you haven't have a goal or you don't have an ambition, you don't have a sort of point in the future that you're aiming towards. But the third most important thing really is that employment gives us connections to other human beings. We might not always like those other human beings, and there is plenty of anecdotal evidence to suggest that the person in the cubicle next to you might not become your very best friend, but we do come into this world joined physically to another person. So our template for peace and equanimity and balance in our life is very much linked to the fact that we have other people in our lives. And we know, and we saw this during the pandemic of all things, that when people feel low, when they feel that their self-worth has been defeated or that they don't see any purpose in life, that we tend to withdraw, we retreat from human beings, and it then becomes a vicious cycle. So if you can get people back into employment, you're actually nourishing them in so many more ways than just financial.
Because the way that this sort of thing is usually written up by the press is that those who are off sick are essentially playing the game. They're swinging the lead. They're taking advantage of us. But it can't be that that is the case with all of the people, particularly since COVID, who have been signed off sick and long-term with depression and anxiety. I mean, those things are real, aren't they?
They definitely exist, but I would put it to you that it also simply cannot be the case that there has been such an exponential explosion in the number of people who need that extra support of being, in effect, signed off, when those very connections, whether it's getting out of the house, getting the exercise that comes with your commute, or actually engaging with other people and having your mind open to new ideas and having people cheer you on in the workplace, we cannot put aside the fact that those things are really, really positive. And whilst there is a political imperative to this, which is about how much money is being spent on sickness benefit, and I completely understand why a government of whatever stripe would want to try to bring that bill down, from a psychological point of view, we are doing a massive disservice to people by simply saying, you know, the cure for this is to just write you off and to give you a sick note and get you to stay at home and have a basically the rest of your life as a duvet day. It's a bit like when you're raising children and there are issues at school and they don't want to go to school. You can indulge that for a little while, but sooner or later you have to pay attention to why they don't want to go to school. Are they being bullied? Do they find it, are they dyslexic? Do they find it too like hard work? Are they being picked on because they're not very sporty? There will often be something behind that. So it isn't enough to say, oh, we've got loads of people who need to be signed off sick. Why are they being signed off sick? What is the nature of their emotional pain that they would go to the doctor and seek to be signed off? And how can we address that? And my role as a psychotherapist is, how do I get somebody back living the life that they deserve to have, a life that is rich in connection, rich in fulfillment, rich in all of the blessings that life can give? And being at home for weeks and months and years on end is never going to achieve that.
Well, you mentioned COVID, and the numbers have rocketed of people long-term sick since COVID. Now, 800,000 people rise in the numbers to 2.8 million, which is about 7.5% of the working population now are off long-term sick. The big increase after COVID, now, was that because that we got used to not working or because COVID itself has had lingering effects?
Well, it's not just one straight answer, actually. For every person who really struggled with not having a job during the pandemic, there was another person who felt freed from the shackle of their current employment and made a decision, I'm going to start my own business, or I'm going to get a job that's closer to home so I don't have that dreadful commute, or I'm going to take early retirement and retrain or volunteer. There were so many different choices that people made. But for sure, in the same way that relationships were put under an awful lot of strain because people were spending more time with each other and they weren't able to get out of the house and they had lots of other pressures, being forced to be in your house and not going out, not seeing your friends, not engaging, not earning money, not earning your full wage because furlough very rarely gave you the full whack, actually really did affect people's mental health. It made them feel unsafe. It made them feel afraid for the future. And it sometimes contributed to their sense of having failed because they would see other people doing really well as a result of the pandemic or COVID in general, that whole experience, and thinking, well, why haven't I had that? So again, you almost have to go to the root cause. What are these people struggling with when they go to see someone like me, or they pitch up at the GP surgery if they can get an appointment, and they say, I can't cope, I am really struggling. We're doing these people a disservice by simply writing them off and giving them sick notes. There are other ways that we could be paying attention to the distress. In the same way as we recognize that so many children aged now between about 15 and 24 whose school years were so badly affected by the closures of schools during the pandemic, we are now making, I hope, strenuous efforts to repair that damage. We need to do the same for the working population who are struggling. They're flagging it up. The depression and the anxiety that they're getting GPs to sign them off for is a signal to the rest of society, I am struggling here. Please, can you help me? But it's my contention that signing them off long term doesn't help them in the long run.
But does the lack of therapists and GPs in the country, is that what actually is underlining this? Because it seems counterintuitive to tell somebody who presents at a medical professional's office with anxiety or depression to tell them that what you really need is to go out and get a job which doesn't sort of take into account all of the other things that might actually make that easier, like talking therapy, for instance.
Well, absolutely. Mental health is always and has long been the Cinderella service of the NHS. There just aren't enough of us around. And also it takes a long time. There are very few quick fixes in life. But in the same way as that there is ample research to suggest that one of the key ways to to help people get out of depression is to take more exercise on a daily basis, so that those sort of feel-good hormones that slosh around your system after exercise can really reinvigorate your mood. Similarly, encouraging people to go back into the workplace or to perhaps do a different job if their original job was really, really making them unwell. And that can happen for sure. There are certain workplaces that really don't suit people. But if you are in a position where you are suggesting to people, get more exercise, change your diet, and reinvigorate your world, one of the ways in which you do that as an adult is to be in employment. And it isn't just about the dignity of work. It is very much about what are the connections, the human engagement, even if it's just that because you always get that bus into the workplace, you always see the same people on the bus, and then you start smiling at them, and then you make a comment about the weather, and before you know it, there's this small little community around you that you didn't have before, that you get used to seeing, and that brightens your day. I know these are going to sound like really tiny things, but they actually really help in terms of boosting your mood, your self-worth, your self-esteem, and that's before you've even got into the workplace. So I speak as someone who would dearly love for everybody to have therapy, just because I think it's so powerful and so transformative. But not everyone can afford it. Not everyone can afford the time. But getting back into the workplace gives you the benefits that you're never going to get by being signed off sick and sitting at home alone.
And do you think that we partly got to this position with so many people being signed off work permanently because GPs and to some extent therapists want an easy life, and if the patient says that that's how they feel, just sign them off and then you can get on with the next patient?
I feel extremely sorry for GPs in particular, because they don't have enough time. They have too many people in their practices, and they simply don't have the time to be able to listen to the stories that some of their patients want to tell. And to some extent, I have a luxurious position, because at least I get to hear that story for 50 minutes. It might be 50 minutes a week, it might be 50 minutes twice a week, but at least I'm hearing that story, and I can start to piece together the jigsaw of why this person feels as diminished as they do emotionally or physically, or sometimes a combination of the two. That's a very luxurious position, both for me, the listener, and for the person who's telling me their story. That's one of the reasons why the pandemic was so so catastrophic, is that we didn't get the chance to tell our stories, because we make sense of the world by telling a story to ourselves and each other about our lives, even if it's how many times do you go into the workplace and everyone's describing their journey or the weather. These are little moments in time where we want to tell people about our experience and have that validated. And if you miss out on that opportunity, which is why loneliness is such a chronic, chronic problem in British society at the moment, if you haven't got people to listen to your story, you are going to be plunged further and further into despair. And that's what I really worry about, which is why, for me, getting people back into employment is one way of making sure they've got people in their lives, connections, who can then start to listen to their story, and you can be a listener of other people's stories. I feel this very, very passionately. It's not a pull yourself together moment, and I don't make it as a political point about the welfare benefits bill. It's really from a psychological perspective of how we can heal society.
The other side of this, which we haven't talked about, is it's one thing to effectively prescribe having a job as a form of treatment, but it's another for an employer to hire someone who has cited mental health issues. It seems unlikely that most employers would welcome somebody like that.
Well, I have two ways of answering that. Firstly, if that was sort of the case, if a similar situation was in place around prisoners, you would point to, you know, companies like Timpson that really do very great work about hiring people who have offended. That actually, if you find the right employer, if you find the right company, and there are increasingly more and more companies who are being led from the top by very enlightened people who have had their own mental health journey and who are very open about talking about it. And in many companies nowadays, there are what is called employee assistance programs, which is where people like me get to go into companies in order to make sure that the workforce is a little bit healthier than it could be. There are more and more enlightened places where they recognize that, yes, you may have been diagnosed with depression or OCD or bipolar or whatever it might be, but you're still a very valuable member of society and you have great skills and we want to tap into them. So I think it's less of a problem than it used to be, but for sure, there are definitely going to be some employers who won't want to listen and they're not the right place for you. You want to work in somewhere where you're valued in the same way as you want to be in a relationship where somebody sees your value, and if they don't, then you have to run.
Good to talk to you, Lucy. Thanks so much for that. Lucy Beresford, psychotherapist and broadcaster. So what do you make of this idea? Britons suffering from anxiety or depression are going to be told by therapists or GPs that work is good for their mental health. Is that tough love or just tough? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC. Tom was our beautiful boy, with a big personality and an even bigger heart. He had the most infectious laugh and the brightest smile. When our family liaison officer explained about the crash, and the deceased person in the car was our son, words cannot explain how that felt. Without Two Wish, I don't honestly think we would get through this.
Two Wish Bereavement Support. If you or someone you know have been affected by the sudden death of a child or young adult, search 2Wish online now to see how we can help.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org, assuming you want to get noticed.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
There are 2.8 million working age people who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness. It's about 7 or 8% of the working age population, and it's a rise of 800,000 since just before the pandemic. And now that may have, lingering health issues. It also perhaps gave people a sense of what it might be like to not work. And to some people, it probably seemed attractive. Others are off sick because of their report mental health issues. And the government, in an attempt to address this, is essentially getting therapists and GPs to write a prescription for a job. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. Lester. Hello, James.
Hi, Nick. Just want to say I love your show and your podcast. I think you're brilliant.
Oh, well, very nice of you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Okay, so my view is that the psychotherapist is doing a massive exercise in overreach, and I think it sounded more like a political dissertation than something a psychotherapist might say.
In what sense?
Well, a psychotherapist isn't an employment expert, for start. A psychotherapist isn't a mental health expert, for start.
Isn't that actually what they are?
No. A psychotherapist is someone that assesses somebody's psychology or psychotherapy, not mental health. Well, they interpret people's behaviour in terms of the way they think and feel.
Right, but they do deal with people with mental health issues. That is, must make up the bulk of their daily job. But over that...
That's not strictly true.
Okay, well, let's just park that. But what is it about what she said that you disagree with?
Well, from her professional standpoint, I don't see how she can make all the claims that she made. So the first one is, people that have been off from COVID, they're just sitting about, they don't want to go to work, they've learned not to be at work, and that's their decision. I'm thinking, well, that's great, that's a brilliant claim to make, where's your evidence for a start?
I'm not sure, I didn't hear her say that, but do you disagree with the idea that work is better for your mental health and your economic health, better for, you know, your friendship circle, better for socialising and so on, than sitting at home off sick for perhaps the rest of your life?
Correct. I agree with you 100%. However, that does determine and depend on what level of mental health problem you've got.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, if you are actually physically and mentally unable to work, well, that's not what we're really talking about. But it seems unlikely.
No, she was.
I'm not sure that's true. It seems unlikely
she said that when people are mentally unwell, they need to go and do some exercise. They need to go to work. They need to get on the bus. They need to speak to people on the bus.
It would be beneficial for them, I think, was her point.
It would be. But the whole point of a diagnosis of depression is that you can't do that.
Right. Well,
it doesn't mean you won't be able to not ever do it.
Yes. Well, we're not talking about people who are so debilitated that they're clinically depressed. We're talking about 2.8 million people. 2.8 million people are not clinically depressed in this country. These are working-age people who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness. And the government is trying to address that. And surely one way to address the people who are on the sort of the lower level of incapacity would be to encourage them to, rejoin the workforce.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. But there's one distinction here that I don't think we've quite grasped.
Which is what?
If they can work, they're not depressed. So they need a different classification.
Right. Okay, well, there are levels of depression, of course. I mean, people say that they're depressed but when they're just having a gloomy day.
Well, that's not depression, is it?
Well, they would say that they're depressed.
Well, they'd be wrong, wouldn't they? That's what a diagnosis is for.
Right. It's a very hard thing to diagnose, though, isn't it?
No, not at all. I was a psychiatric nurse for 20 years. I've got a neuroscience degree, integrative neuroscience theorist. I've got a pretty good idea of what depression is and what it isn't.
Well, yes, but you have to base your theory or your diagnosis dependent on what people say to you, which makes it a difficult thing to address.
Well, it does, but there's a process, isn't there? So, if you go to the GPs and the GP says you're depressed, well, okay, that's fine. That's a diagnostic clarification based on a set of symptoms, right? If they're not improving in their depression, then the GP then needs to refer them on to the psychiatrist. That would be the normal standard procedure. And the psychiatrist, who is the apparent expert in that system, will then say, well, actually, I don't think you are, or I do think you are depressed. Okay? If they said, I don't think you're depressed, then they'll discharge them back to the GP. If they said, I do think you're depressed, well, then they say, well, are you depressed enough to need further support or assistance? Okay? So then the psychiatrist would say, well, okay, you need a social worker or a psychiatrist or whatever, and it'd be the multidisciplinary team, and that would then continue, and then you would get more support or less support as needed.
Right.
And out of social services.
That might be best policy, but all of the people that you've just mentioned in that ladder are in short supply. So, I mean, what you just said could take years. And so to maybe get around that, GPs account for more than 9 in 10 of fit notes that are issued. According to figures last week, 93% of notes issued by doctors say a patient is not fit for work. That seems unlikely, 93%.
It's a diagnostic issue, isn't it?
Right. Okay, well, that's an interesting take. Thanks for that, James. Bristol, Tiago.
Oh, hi, Nick. Thanks for having me on. I haven't caught the full conversation before. I just tuned in and I had to call. I'm currently myself, experiencing what I believe to be depression. And I say what I believe because the how the diagnostic, you know, happened, it's nothing short of inadequate, to be very honest. So this was my own assessment of the situation and going to a GP and being, well, I believe that that's the case, then giving me a form to fill, me scoring the right number, and they're like, do you want some pills? Here they are. That's my experience with my depression threatened.
And did they give you a note that say you're not fit to work?
Not just yet.
No.
And that's because I refused one. So I happened to be...
So they offered you one?
So I was, I've been on Universal Credit for a few months now. I'm a freelancer and I work in film and TV, and the industry took a bit of a bump last year.
Mm.
And it's been kind of hard to get back on the horse. And part of what I feel right now is a lot to do with that. My sense of self and pride is highly attached to my career, and it's struggling with my career has driven me into this place where I am now,
yeah,
where I'm struggling to get back. But while I was talking to my job coach on the job center, who I don't even want to get into how inadequate the advice they have for someone like me, who is a freelancer, is, because they have very basic, you know, ideas of a job market that feels very much rooted on some sort of New York sitcom about the 80s. You know, it's just very outdated what they think it is to get a job. But anyhow, moving on from that part, when I mentioned to them that I was entering the depression treatment at the job center, the attitude changed very quickly. And it was like, oh, you know, if you are depressed, then you don't need to come and attend the appointments if you have a note from your GP. And I was like, well, at this stage, I'm not feeling great, but actually, and as much as I find those appointments frustrating and at times pointless, the accountability of me coming here is one of the few things that's keeping me from drowning completely. And I know some people do need to be given space to breathe, but I told them I don't. I just need to keep active. When I then mentioned to my GP what I've been told by the folks at the job center, he was like, yeah, you can get a note. I was like, but is anyone wanting to listen to what I'm saying that I don't want to be signed off?
Yeah.
I want additional help to get back out there, and being told that I don't need to bother going to the appointments on the job center because I have this note is not what I need right now.
Well, maybe.
Right there in front of me.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. And maybe this initiative where people are going to be persuaded back into the workplace, and you want to go, so you're kind of ahead of the curve in that regard. Maybe this policy, depends on how it is rolled out, will be the very thing that you're looking for, Tiago. And I wish you the very best. I've just run out of time on this subject, but thanks for that. Going to take a short break for the news, after which it's kind of related. It's a health issue. The number of NHS appointments, tests and operations delivered by private hospitals and clinics has increased by almost 500,000 this year to 6.15 million. It's about to become even more prevalent, and we'll look at what is behind that issue with a health commentator. That's after this news update with Tim Daly.
The father of Hadosh Kabatu's teenage victim says he was infuriated by the accidental release of the sex offender and asylum seeker from prison. The 38-year-old Ethiopian disappeared on Friday before being rearrested in North London on Sunday morning. Data from the Maine Nursing Union shows a large rise in members suffering racial abuse and discrimination at work. The Royal College of Nursing is now calling on employers to prioritise tackling racism. And forecasters in the Caribbean are warning a hurricane heading for Jamaica could become a Category 5 storm. The weather system, named Melissa, is due to hit the island on Monday night, bringing rain and winds of around 145 miles per hour. LBC weather, clear spells followed by scattered showers overnight, especially in northern and western areas. The winds will strengthen as well, and we'll see a low of around 7 degrees.
LBC.
Tom was our beautiful boy, with a big personality and an even bigger heart. He had the most infectious laugh and the brightest smile. When our family liaison officer explained about the crash, and the deceased person in the car was our son, words cannot explain how that felt. Without To Wish, I don't honestly think we would get through this.
To Wish Bereavement Support. If you or someone you know have been affected by the sudden death of a child or young adult, search To Wish online now to see how we can help.
Half term is here. I've 100% got this. They will keep a lid on the glitter and they will not ambush my work calls. But if all else fails, McDonald's Seal Drop.
Get 15% off the whole menu when you spend £15 on food and drink. Redeem this half term only on the McDonald's app. Fees apply to delivery. 18 plus, one-time use per week until the 2nd of November. Participating restaurants, T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Using spare capacity in the private sector is key to the government's target of ensuring that 92% of patients in England should wait no longer than 18 weeks from referral to treatment. That's the plan. Let's talk about that plan with Roy Lilly. He is a health policy commentator and former NHS Trust chair. Hello, Roy.
Hello, Nick. Good evening.
What do you make of this?
Well, look, I think it's a bit of window dressing, to be honest. I mean, there's no philosophical argument between the NHS and the private sector. It's always presented like that. But, you know, it's NHS nurses that work, you know, do a bit of overtime in the private sector a lot in a lot of cases. It's always NHS consultants, because they're the only ones by law allowed to practice privately. So it's always NHS consultants that work in the private sector. There's a huge overlap. The question is, you know, what the private sector can do and how much they can do. Well, they've done 600,000 procedures, operations or diagnostics, which is fine. If you're one of the 600,000 people, good luck, you know, and I hope it went well. But in the actual scheme of things, when you've got 7.5 million people on a waiting list, and when you've got, you know, 1.5 million people joining the waiting list every month, 1.5 million roughly coming off the waiting list every month, you know, it gets back to the old advert, you know, every little helps, but it's not going to make a huge difference.
Yeah, people might be surprised at the extent of private medical providers, because they report, you know, working within the NHS, they deliver about 10% of elective NHS activity at the moment. So presumably that's going to skyrocket.
Well, it's one in 10, and I don't think they can do... I don't think they can do much more of that, more than that. They're constrained with what they can do. They can't do anything complicated because most private hospitals don't have an ITU. So that means if something goes wrong with an operation, they have to ring 999 and get an ambulance and get people transferred into the NHS. And that happened 600 times last year. So it's, you know, it's not unusual for it to happen. So there's that. And there's another knock-on issue here, which a lot of people perhaps may not understand, and I'll try and explain it. The private sector do fairly simple things. So they'll do things like hip operations with people with what we call comorbidity, nothing else wrong with them. And of course, hip operations are generally done on older people who do have comorbidities. So they'll do things like cataract operations. Now, the private sector is doing more cataract operations than the NHS is doing. So, I mean, that's a big statistic. But the difficulty with that is that cataract operations are easy to do. There's very little post-operative follow-up. It can be done on the phone. Very little ever goes wrong with cataract operations. So they're simple, cheap to do, and they generate a lot of revenues for the private sector. The difficulty with that is, of course, that the hospital loses that revenue. Now, what happens when you run a hospital is you use the revenues that come in to cross-subsidize things which aren't quite so profitable. So, for example, if you're running an ophthalmic department, then, you know, the money that you would have had from doing cataract operations would cross-subsidize into things like macular degeneration, retinopathy for people with diabetes and so on, and the more complicated things that are being done for people in their eyesight. So the NHS loses that, and it also loses the opportunity for training doctors to carry out those cataract operations as part of their training. So they lose that training opportunity as well. So although it's good for patients, and I understand that, it does have a knock-on effect within the NHS.
Yes, so, I mean, politically, it's quite attractive, I would imagine, to receive benefit in the short term by throwing money at the private sector. But I think what you're saying is that it is it detrimental to the NHS in the long term, because you're spending money in the short term to prop up the profitability of private companies, not investing in the NHS for the future?
Yes, that's the argument that people use, and you know, you can see that. Of course you can. But if, you know, if you're a patient that's benefiting from it, well, then good luck. But it's, you know, it's not making a huge difference, and it is taking quite a chunk of money out of the NHS. And I think really a lot of it also is political signalling. A lot of it is signalling that, you know, we're the Labour Party, but we're not anti-business. You know, we're pro-NHS, but we're not anti-private sector. And of course, this goes back quite a long way. Back to 2000, when Tony Blair was around, he's the first Prime Minister to sign what was called a concordat, an agreement note with the private sector, so that the NHS would agree to contract with the private sector to do NHS procedures. And that was the concordat that really broke the ground and relationship between the Labour Party, who, I mean, most people regard the Labour Party as being sort of home of the NHS. And it was Tony Blair who signed the Concordat agreement for the private sector to come in and do NHS procedures. It was done NHS tariffs, actually, at the time. But it was done, and of course people saw money, an outflow of money from the NHS into the private sector, and, you know, to dividends and profits and so on and so forth. So there's a philosophical argument, there's a training argument, and there's a sort of financial argument as well.
And has the amount of work that the NHS has given the private sector increased in that intervening period, or has it remained more or less flat? Doing the sort of things that you've described, the easy stuff?
No, it's increased. And the NHS has more contracts now for work with the private sector than it did even before COVID. So no, it has increased. And, you know, don't get me wrong, it's a good thing for the people who are involved. You know, if you get the opportunity to have your operation done quicker in the private sector, well, you know, who wouldn't say yes? I understand it.
Some people have voiced concern at the health secretary's, his announcements in the past. He's spoken about privatisation and so on. Do you think that this is actually what we're on, the path to the privatisation of the NHS?
No, I don't. I really don't. I mean, if you want the private sector, I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, an insurance-based system. And, well, look, you know, if you're going to pay insurance premiums, you can take that out of your left-hand pocket. You take your taxes out of your right-hand pocket. It's still your trousers. You've still got to pay. And by far and away, the most efficient way of collecting money for the NHS is to collect it through taxation, and then redistribute it through the system to the NHS. So that's the cleanest, easiest way to do it. There are issues around whether or not the private sector should be doing more work in the NHS. And the Tories, actually, before they got thrown out in the last election, they were putting in hubs, diagnostic hubs. And Steve Barclay was the Secretary of State who did that, and he got the private sector to come in and fund some of these hubs so that we could push more people through the diagnostics. Because if you think about it, about 30% of people on a waiting list, perhaps even more, are there for a diagnostic. Now, half of them will have a diagnostic and require no more further treatment, and half of them may go on to need a day case treatment or perhaps a period of inpatient care. But diagnostics is the key to getting the waiting list down, because you can sort out who needs what and when. So putting money, getting the private sector to come in and do diagnostics was a good idea. The difficulty with that is, of course, the diagnostic equipment, things like MRI scanners and so on, they cost a fortune. And to get the money back, the private sector have to have contracts over a long period so they can amortize their investment. So I think that, you know, from the relationship point of view, I don't think it's a privatization of the NHS, but I do think we could expect to see more private providers come in and provide certain services. I mean, in mental health, particularly at the high end of risk patients in the mental health, a lot of that is provided in the private sector.
So it sounds like the NHS is not being privatised, but it is being made into an organisation that rents its treatment from private organisations. You know, much in the same way that buildings were put up and we didn't own them, like hospitals. We just rented them forever. So it looked good in the short term, that, you know, we were building all of these hospitals, but it didn't benefit us financially because we were paying for them from now until the end of time.
Yes, you know, in the longer run, the right way to run the NHS is to fund it properly and get all the work done in the NHS, because it's done without having to make a profit or give money to dividends and shareholders, and every penny that taxpayers' money goes into the NHS is spent on the NHS and treatments for patients. I mean, that's the way it was set up. That's the way it's supposed to work. To bring the private sector in to do ancillary work or even principal and primary work is good for patients because it gets some things done quicker, and that's a good thing for patients. But in the longer run, it does damage the NHS, and it's not good for the NHS, it's not good for training, and it's not good for finance, and it's not good really for investing in equipment as well. So, you know, there's a philosophical argument. It's the argument, the traditional argument that's been due in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. Although it has to be said, most of the bigger inroads that the private sector have made into the NHS were made principally during the Blair years, when Anna Milburn was the Secretary of State for Health, and he's back, of course, now as an advisor to Wes Streeting. That's 20 years later. And perhaps we're seeing some of his ideas coming to fruition and into play now.
I mean, just in terms of how it will work, how confident are you that NHS management will be able to strike deals with the private sector that don't essentially end up ripping us taxpayers off?
Well, that's pretty tricky. Tricky to answer. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the value of the contracts. When Andrew Lansley introduced his reforms, the last of the reforms that we just got rid of, he allowed a lot more flexibility in the volumes of work that was to be done in the private sector. But he said it had to be done at tariff. Now, the tariff is the price list that the NHS charges itself for doing work. So, you know, there wasn't any creaming off of the contracts. That's been changed slightly now since, where there are block contracts and other styles of contracts which do benefit volume and there are more margins in it just to get the work done. Because, you know, here we are with stuck pretty much with 7.5 million people on the waiting list. The thing about a waiting list is not the numbers of people on the waiting list, but it's the length of time you wait for treatment. And that's the difficulty. So they can't get the flow through the system because hospitals are chock-a-block for all sorts of other reasons. So I think, you know, to answer your question, in the longer run, are we likely to see more private participants in the system? I think probably yes. I think particularly as the data and the access to records and so on becomes a lot easier, I think it's highly likely that we will see more private players come into the system. I do. And I think it was simply because of the volumes that the NHS can cope with. And you can argue, I mean, there is an argument, you know, every penny that you give to the private sector, you're not investing in the capacity of the NHS. And governments always seem to me to be confused about what it is actually they're trying to do. I mean, if you look at the Labour Party's situation now, they've got one wing of the party, I'm sure, that will be very much against the idea of giving any money to the private sector at all. And they'd say we should be investing in the NHS. And they've got other constituency MPs are saying, you know, my constituents, Mrs. Williams, can't get a hip operation. What are you doing about it? And they're saying, well, we will engage with the private sector to use their capacity. It will never be the determinant factor, I don't think, because the private sector is really relatively small. It is very small. And geographically as well, the distribution isn't equal throughout the UK. So you generally get private hospitals and private sector working in areas where there's a, you know, quite a lot of wealth and wealthy areas. Mm. And if you look at the NHS waiting lists, generally they're higher in areas of higher deprivation.
Yeah. And finally, just out of interest, when procedures are done through the NHS in private facilities, as you've mentioned, the doctors and the nurses will be NHS trained and working in the NHS. So will the NHS be paying for their time on NHS rates, or will we be paying for consultants at their private rate?
The private sector will be paying the NHS consultants working in their private time at private rates, whatever that is, and that varies. I mean, you know, there's no particular rate card, and so I can't answer specifically how much an hour or procedure a consultant will be charged, will be paid, but it won't be at NHS rates, no.
Right. Good to talk to you, Roy. Thanks very much for that. Roy Lilly, health policy commentator, former NHS Trust chair. Now, just before that, we were talking about GPs and therapists being urged to prescribe having a job for depressed and anxious patients in a bid to slash the spiralling benefits bill. Robert's been waiting to talk on that subject. What's your experience, Robert?
Hello, Nick. I'm just happy that I can talk to somebody who's got a clear style and who's coherent. I couldn't agree with Lucy more from what she said. But in practice, in real terms, it doesn't happen. I was 42 and I was a professional accountant working for a blue chip company. I got stressed out and worked very hard. I had a heart attack. The cardiologist told me I had to rest my heart for 2 years. Now, when you try to go back to the market then and say, well, look, the first thing they're going to ask you is, well, what have you been doing for the last 2 years? Mm. Well, I've had a heart attack. Why should we put you in this stressful role? Especially now they've changed things and said, you're going to get full workers' rights from day one. Why would they take a chance, put me in that role? So what happens is you don't start off with the anxiety and depression. You've lost your career, you've lost your profession, you've lost your health, you've got no money, you lose your connections, which is what Lucy was saying. So then you start suffering with the anxiety and the depression, and they become your major illnesses because your heart's repaired or your back's repaired or what other problem. And once you're out of work, then it's all algorithms on, you know, you're applying online for a job. Well, what have you been doing for the last 2 years? Well, I've been recovering from a heart attack. I've been recovering from a back problem. I've had a knee operation. And you're not going to get the job. And, you know, when you get over a certain age, I've heard very reliable information. When you're over the 55s, a lot of the algorithms will exclude you. So I want to be back in that scene that I was in. And I couldn't... I've been excluded from it. And it's easy for people to say, oh, there's all these employers. They don't exist. It's very hard to find them. And if you're down and you've had a lot of problems and you've been ill and you've been out of the loop for a couple of years, you know, it's very, very hard to find these people who will help you. And what I ended up doing, I ended up setting up a business to be self-employed to manage my conditions, a little gardening business. But I lost my career. I've lost all those contacts. I've lost all my qualifications. And I feel bereft. I feel I've been cheated. And it's basically because everything's online. And, you know, so you put all your details in. And if you've had some major illness and it's lasted, you're excluded.
Yeah.
What's happened.
Yes, well, I did feel that was one of the fundamental flaws in the plan. I mean, it's one thing to say to somebody who has the ability to work but hasn't been doing that the best thing for you is to go get a job, but the other side of it is finding an employer who wants to give you that job.
Yeah, and it's got worse since they've said we'll give workers rights from day one. Now when I first set up my little business, which was 10 years ago because I had this heart attack 19 years ago, and I spent ages on benefits and trying to get off them and all the rest of it, the government offered a scheme at some point where it says, we'll give you so much money and so much tax credits and we'll send you on this little course to set up your own business. And it was a bit of a way out, and I took that opportunity, even though it wasn't something that I was trained to do. And I still feel like an outsider when I'm in people's gardens because it's not my profession. But the thing is, it gave me a way back. But people are being bullied now and there's no way for them to get back.
Yeah.
Once you fill in that application form online, young people with really good qualifications that come out of university with higher degrees, and they can't get jobs, they can't get through the algorithms. They're having to apply for 300 jobs. But you get somebody who's, like my friend, she got ill with the stomach, she's working in the care home. She's 50. She's been ill for 2 years. She applied to her saying, I'm feeling a bit better, I'd like a job. It's not going to happen. There's no way back. And I've been referred by my doctor recently for mental health help. And they put me in through to one of these psychologists like Lucy, who was helping people get back to work when they've lost their career. And we did come to this same conclusion. She said, the algorithms will stop you because you're over a certain age. Now, it's all right if you're still working, say, like yourself. You've got a good connection, a good network. You've got people around you, but you lose all that when you get ill and you've been off the scene for 2 years.
Mm.
And then, so you're looking for your peer group to lift you up. They're not there anymore.
Yeah. But, I mean, there is some positive. I think you've chosen a marvellous thing to do. I mean, being outside and in gardens is... it's the thing that I would have done had I not done this. That's pretty much the only other thing that really interested me. Robert, I'm going to have to go because I'm past the break, but I really appreciate that, and I wish you all the best. Thanks very much. 0345-6060-973. Going to take a break and then hopefully talk to our correspondent from the US.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Clive Bull.
The annual Life in the UK survey just out this morning says the average person thinks things haven't got better under Labour in its first year. Do you agree?
Clive Bull on LBC.
Half term is here. I've 100% got this. They will keep a lid on the glitter and they will not ambush my work calls. But if all else fails, McDonald's deal drop.
Get 15% off the whole menu when you spend £15 on food and drink. Redeem this half term only on the McDonald's app. Fees apply to delivery. 18 plus, one time use per week until the 2nd of November. Participating restaurants, T's and C's apply.
Hi, we're Travel Essence, experts in tailor-made holidays to Australia and New Zealand. We craft personal, authentic journeys that take it slow and truly connect you with the land, where you walk in the footsteps of ancient ancestors, soak up Indigenous culture, and uncover the unspoiled essence of Down Under. Travelessence.co.uk. Go deeper, Down Under.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The sun goes on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
Imagine the varifocal lens of the future, personalised to you, engineered with artificial intelligence and powered by your visual behaviour. Experience instantly sharp vision in motion with Varilux XR Pro lenses from Essilor. Find your local optician at Essilor.com and ask for Varilux XR Pro.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Right, we're going to talk things American now. David Smith is the Washington Bureau Chief at The Guardian and joins us on the line now. Hello, David.
Hello.
So, Donald Trump is spreading happiness and joy as he sweeps through Southeast Asia. What do we know about the trip so far?
Well, he's been in Malaysia. I believe he's off to Japan next. And one of the big issues throughout this trip is U.S. trade relations with China. And it has been claimed by Trump's Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, that we have a framework of a deal that will avert an all-out trade war between the world's two biggest economies. The U.S. would back down on its threat of further 100% tariffs. And, of course, we know tariffs are a favorite weapon of Donald Trump. And China, in turn, would back away from restrictions on rare earth minerals. An interesting part of this negotiation is the future of the app TikTok. And again, Bessent said they've reached a final deal on that. He was not disclosing particular details of what that deal looks like. Certainly in recent weeks, it's been reported that it would be valued at about $14 billion, and the majority of the U.S. and international investors would own about 65% of the company. Oversight of its algorithm would go to them. And some interesting names attached to that speculation about Rupert Murdoch getting involved, possibly Larry Ellison, who's the second richest man in the world and a big Trump ally, and maybe even a seat on the board for 19-year-old Baron Trump, the president's son.
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah. Meanwhile,
sort of inevitable. Yeah.
Meanwhile, Trump is having another spat with Canada, which doesn't make any sense at all because he's complaining about something that is, he's complaining that something is false, that is actually true, and that's that Ronald Reagan spoke quite vociferously against Donald Trump's favorite weapon, which is tariffs. And Trump says that the video that Canada put out is artificial intelligence, but it's not, is it?
That's right. Yeah, all pretty extraordinary. This issue about Ronald Reagan's views on tariffs has been around for several months within the US. Some of Trump's critics have pointed out, you know, this icon of Republican politics, one of the favorite presidents, spoke very sharply against tariffs and how detrimental it would be for American workers. So that clip has been around. Canadians, specifically the province of Ontario, used it in an advert. The one thing they did do was they slightly changed the order of Reagan's speech, but nevertheless it was his voice, his words.
Yeah. And what's extraordinary was that the Reagan Institute, I can't remember its full name, but that's more or less it, they said, this is an absolute outrage and we're considering our legal options. If you want to listen to the entire speech, here's a link. I guess they assumed that people wouldn't bother, because if you followed the link and listened to the speech, it is exactly how the Canadians portrayed it.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that the Canadians played it during the World Series, which is currently an American team versus a Canadian team, rubbed salt in the wound. And so Trump has lashed out with an extra 10% tariffs. And one aspect of this I think that's also interesting is, you know, Trump himself has been pumping out AI videos in recent months. Notoriously,
embarrassing for a 14-year-old child whiling away their time in their bedroom, but absolutely mortifying for the president of the United States of America. And it does occur to me that, you know, Ronald Reagan, this icon of Republican politics, as you said, he wouldn't even get into Trump's Republican Party these days, would he?
No, that's right. You now have Democrats kind of favorably quoting Ronald Reagan, both on tariffs and indeed on immigration, where he was very inclusive and he was pro-immigration, completely out of step with Trump. And yet Trump still hangs a very big portrait of Reagan in the Oval Office.
Hard to believe that Reagan is too woke to get into the Republican Party now. I'm going to have to cut it there, unfortunately, David. I've just run out of time, but thanks so much for that. That's David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief at The Guardian. If you missed any of today's show, it's on Global Player or the new LBC app, both of which are free from your app store. Ian Payne at 4. First, Clyde Ball.
Nick, thank you. Coming up after the news, the annual Life in the UK survey just out this morning says that the average person has seen no meaningful improvement in their life under Labour. Is that true for you? Have things got better or worse in Labour's first year? Plus, a top psychiatrist has spoken out about cannabis, warning that it's damaging young people's brains, and CBD products and aggressive lobbying are being blamed for complacency. Have we got the right approach to cannabis in this country? Plus, why family and independent vets are disappearing, prices are rising, what's your experience of getting your pet treated? That and more after the news at 1.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Justice Secretary is expected to announce an independent inquiry later on today into the accidental release of the asylum seeker and sex offender Hadish Kabatu. David Lammy is due to speak in Parliament after saying the Ethiopian national should be deported in the coming week. The 38-year-old was rearrested in North London on Sunday morning. Chief Executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, Andrea Coomber, has been telling LBC the accidental release demonstrates a wide range of problems.
Is a very troubled prison, and obviously we await a formal investigation. But it has previously, like a couple of years ago, had an urgent notification from the the chief inspector of prisons that this was not a good jail. We know that staff in most prisons are, you know, have got less than 2 years of experience.
Police investigating what's being called a racially aggravated rape in the West Midlands say they're not linking the attack with any others. Officers were called to an area of Walsall on Saturday evening. It's being claimed nearly two-thirds of charities have reduced their workforce and cut services because of finances and staff burnout. A study by an investment firm says many are dealing with falling incomes and declining public donations. Two men have been arrested by French detectives investigating last week's robbery at the Louvre Museum in Paris. Reports are claiming one of them was about to fly to Algeria on Saturday evening. The Paris-based journalist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet has been talking to LBC.
It is now coming out that this was a commission possibly from a Russian person, and the Russian person can be anybody from the part of the notorious Eastern European treasure robbery gangs, or that could even be a nice catch from President Putin.
A leading property website is claiming the usual pre-Christmas slowdown in the housing market has begun early this year. Zoopla is partly blaming uncertainty being created by the autumn budget. It says people are concerned about potential effects on stamp duty. And in sport, Arsenal are now 4 points clear at the top of the Premier League following a 1-0 win against Crystal Palace on Sunday. Bournemouth have jumped up to second place after beating Nottingham Forest 2-0. LBC weather, clear spells followed by scattered showers overnight, particularly for northern and western areas. The winds will strengthen as well, and we'll see a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Clive Ball.
Very good morning to you. I'm Clive Bull. This is LBC and I'm here for an extra one. I'm normally here on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday morning, but I'm in on a Monday morning, in for Richard Spur, who's got a couple of weeks off. Jim Diamond will be here tomorrow, but an extra one from me. And we've got a busy one as well. Lots to talk about this morning. I want to talk about Labour and your feeling about whether life has improved or not over the first year of Labour. I have a suspicion that it's not quite as bad as we are being told we should feel. But the annual Life in the UK survey is just out this morning, and it says that the average person has seen no meaningful improvement in their life in Labour's first year. So, I mean, I'll tell you a bit more about what this survey says, but I'd like to know from you whether you think that's true. If you think about it, last 12 months or so, have things got better, worse? Do you feel more hopeful, less hopeful? Where do you, and do it sort of hand on heart, really. Don't be influenced by just everything we're told about, you know, Starmer's a disaster and this and that. And that, how do you actually feel? Do you feel like things are getting worse or things are getting better? To coin a famous Tony Blair phrase, have things got better or worse under Labour? I'll tell you more about what this survey says about our feelings, our well-being, both in life and in economic terms as well. It seems sort of, well, it's being portrayed as very negatively, like no meaningful improvement. You could equally say, well, it's neutral. It's not worse, it's not better. Just compare it to what was there before and think about, well, actually, what has got worse under Keir Starmer and what has got better? Or are you hopeful at least? I'd like to get into that a little bit this morning. And if you'd like to comment, please do. By the way, you can call in on any of our topics all the way through till four on the usual number. The number being 0345 6060973. You can call in. If you can call in, that would be great, because I would really like to have a chat. But if you can't, then send a WhatsApp message on the same number. You can text as well, 84850, or you can talk into an Alexa and say, Alexa, send a comment to LBC. So that's one thing. Labour, is it better or worse? In the light of this survey, Secondly, cannabis. And a lot of coverage today about this top psychiatrist who has spoken out about cannabis, warning that it is damaging young people's brains, which is maybe something that we sort of knew but is not said very often. And it's being blamed. There's a sort of complacency, she says, because of lobbying by cannabis lobby, cannabis products, CBD is very fashionable. So parents are being left thinking, well, it's just cannabis, doesn't really matter. It's got quite good PR. And she says that's not right, especially with young people. There's an estimated 2.3 million people using cannabis in any one year in the UK. So have we got the right approach to cannabis, the right attitude towards cannabis, the right approach both legally and generally in this country? I want to talk about cannabis as well, and we'll tell you more about what that psychiatrist said. Later on as well, vets. I want to talk about vets. Are they good value? Why are family and independent vets disappearing? And we'll also be talking to Dean Dunham, our consumer expert at LBC, who's going to be talking about all the complaints that have been made. 1.85 million complaints just in the first 6 months of this year made about financial companies, banks, investments, pensions, credit cards. We'll have more about that a little later as well. And if you'd like to comment on any of this as we go through, feel free. Just join in. Give me a call, 0345 6060973. And if you send a message, then I will do my best to include all the messages that come through. I can't guarantee every single one because some of them are not suitable for reading out. They're really not. And they get you into trouble and me into trouble. But